as you look at their actions, the political power is to bring about what they call a new world order, which is a one world. They use the Hegelian techniques, and we know enough about Hegel to know that not only does this mean the dialectic process, the creation of conflict, but it also means that individuals such as you and I, or anybody watching this program, will be cogs in the state, that we have no individual rights. Individual rights for Hegel come about through obedience to the state. We see it in the educational process. We have adopted what I call a Hegelian system of education, which is not to bring out your innate talents, but to prepare you to be an individual cog in the state.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 9th of April 2021. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We're streaming live at PRSC Radio and also at RadioQUK.com. In the second part, the FLCCC, the Frontline COVID Care Clinicians weekly podcast. Why don't Western leaders want to save people's lives with ivermectin? Who are these leaders working for? Because it doesn't seem to be for us. And we hear from Dr. Pierre Corey getting increasingly frustrated about the stonewalling by the so-called scientists. And the post-vaccine sickness being censored. The British Medical Journal reports being ignored. Well, this is because it's the wrong story, isn't it? Actually, the vaccine is the hard sell, with the pharmaceutical industry writing our news bulletins, not journalists. And Vernon Coleman, the doctor, the famous doctor, bows out of his almost daily videos that broke the spine of YouTube and brought forth brand new Tube. He explains that. And the EU has decided, the European Court of, guess what, yes, human rights, has decided that vaccinations can be mandatory in a democracy. Oh, so that's no more Nuremberg principles then, those thrown into the Lake of Geneva, or the Muggle say. Coercion is the policy of the European Court of Human Rights. And the latest from Steve Hilton, and Martin will be pleased about this because he's on a different tack from last week, it's the last boss of the US National Institute of Health saying that COVID leaked from a lab. This is nobody but the last boss of the National Institute of Health saying this. And it's not from the nose of a batty bat or a pandemic pangolin, no, from a laboratory. And so more fascinating even is that this programme, Steve Hilton and the Next Revolution, is pinning that on Fauci and on various US officials for doing it there in Wuhan rather than the Chinese. And the Russian ambassador ain't coming back. So that's what the Russians are saying. Well, he may at some point, but he's saying that there needs to be some realistic bilateral relations between America and Russia before Anatoly Antonov is going to go back to Washington. Now, hardly reported this, but this is totally unprecedented since the time of the Russian Revolution. There's always been an ambassador for Russia or the Soviet Union in Washington, but not for the last 2 weeks and not into the indefinite future now. So why isn't this being reported? We're looking at various places around the world, some hot spots, Mozambique, Ukraine, Ethiopia and Yemen. And do you trust Alexei Navalny's German political hospital? As it's coming out from on the Fort Russ website, that it kills some people and cures other, depending on their politics, this hospital. Obviously, it was lucky that they cured Alexei Navalny. He was a favoured political tool. And the reopening of the 9/11 inquest, Matt Campbell on his attempts to bring new evidence into the court here in the UK. And the beginning of a four-part review, a final item this week of the most explosive audio of all time, that's according to me, looking at, over the next few weeks, the Illuminati, the JFK assassination, the Skull and Bones cult at Yale University. But to begin this week, Bill Cooper and the beast opposed to the Bible, the deep state man, is at least saying that man is nothing more than an animal. The philosophy behind that. But first, Prince Philip. Well, we can talk a bit in a minute about deadly viruses, about vaccine side effects, particularly Pfizer vaccine side effects, and also Prince Philip's view on the National Health Service. as well as Piers Corbyn standing for Mayor of London and Labour councillors endorsing him. Will Keir Starmer dare to sack them? And here in Bristol, we have the Police and Crime Commissioner elections, and the 200 victims of Lloyds Bank fraud are giving their recommendations of which candidates to vote for if we want to kill white-collar bankster crime and get people in front of a judge and a jury, which hasn't been happening, has it, under Sue Mount-Stevens and Andy Marsh. A ruling against Avon and Somerset, though, is just come through from the Law Lords, and one candidate definitely not to vote for, according to Trevor Mealham, and the victims. Plus, could this be why so-called independent PCC, the crime commissioner who's married to a chair of the Business West Chamber of Commerce, and Chief Constable Andy Marsh are both standing down? Andy Marsh shocked people this week by saying he won't be reapplying, so he's off. And plus the priest, crime, courts and sentencing bill, how 20,000 people in the Bristol area could be criminalised. This is what's behind this Kill the Bill protest. Up to 1 million across the whole of the UK. Should we be making people criminals for not being able to pay the rent or the mortgage? Perhaps it's the failed housing system and the failed benefit system that needs fixing, eh? But anyway, let's start with Prince Philip, Martin. What's your general view of the guy? Is it you? I mean, I hate to say it, but are you glad to see the back of him, or are you a little bit sad today, or is it completely mean nothing to you?
Well, I mean, the guy was 99 years old. So it's not really a surprise. He's not been in particularly good health in recent years, has he?
Well, it is a surprise because everyone was made to believe that he'd had an operation a few weeks ago and he'd come back to Windsor Castle, and he was healthy. So he'd gone through that operation.
Well, I mean, people, all sorts of people at that age have operations and then something else just comes along immediately afterwards. It's not really a surprise that a 99-year-old has died, let's face it. I was a bit surprised this afternoon because the whole of the media have just gone into this constant discussion about him.
Well, we'll it's try and get it over us.
I don't mind. I thought there might be 10 minutes. I was listening to Radio 3 and I thought, well, they might have 10 minutes about him and then they'll go back to the music. No, I thought, well, maybe it's just going to be an hour or so. But they're still, you know, the whole of programmes across the BBC, radio and television, have just been cancelled.
Martin, there's one radio station right now, right across the BBC, regional, and, I mean, Radio Wales and things like this, and the local radio stations all have just Evan Davis, or had Evan Davis on there, chit-chatting. I think it's the idea really is to control the narrative of this. Obviously, you know, the BBC is a royal charter, but they're making a blatant attempt to make sure that certain aspects of this are not discussed, I think, by trying to control...
I just think it's over the top. I mean, it's like a military coup almost, you know, where you switch the television on and all there is old movies and so on. I mean, I don't mind them taking some notice of it. Obviously, it's of some interest. But this is extreme. And don't forget, he's not the head of state. Queen's the head of state.
Yeah, but did Prince Philip have any power?
Well, he must have had some. Yeah, I mean, of course he had some power. You know, people in his position, he was advisor to the Queen. And the Queen, as we found out in recent years, was able behind the scenes to vet any and veto any parliamentary legislation which affected her personal interests, and to keep the lid on that. And no doubt he was privy to those secrets.
He's now free to come back as a deadly virus, isn't he? 33
years
ago.
That's what he famously said at one stage, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, Prince Philip spoke on the topic of reincarnation and what he would come back as if such a thing existed. He said, "In the event that I am reincarnated, I would like to return as a deadly virus to contribute something to solving overpopulation." But this is actually, it's a little quip, but you know, do you think he was a eugenicist?
I think it's pretty clear from that sort of comment that he was. And people say he's only, you know, he was one of the founders of the World Wildlife Fund, which has now become something else. I've forgotten what it's called these days. But I mean, they have a reputation for, you know, in developing countries, for, you know, they care about wildlife, but they don't care too much about people. And
I thought it was an intelligence, Martin. I thought the World Wildlife Fund was an intelligence front.
Well, indeed, this is the point I'm making. I think they've cleaned up their act a bit since they began. and they're now part of what you might call the NGO consensus, that if you're going to save wildlife, you've also got to help the people who live with wildlife. But, I mean, the whole creation, if you think back to the 50s, of things like safari parks and so on, is really geared towards keeping people out of what became, you know, tourist destinations for the super wealthy, and the problems of and therefore bringing in foreign exchange, supposedly. But of course, all that does is pay off the international debt that you've imposed on the countries that you're visiting.
I think they've become more
sensitive now than they were in the past to the fact that they're, you know, a lot, you know, caring about cuddly baboons and so on. It doesn't feed any children.
Well, he made the deadly virus remarks to Deutsche Presseagentur, a German news agency. So he's made a number of gaffes, well, you could say gaffes, during his time of public service. Speaking to a Scottish driving instructor in 1995, he asked, "How do you keep the natives off the booze long enough to pass the test?"
Yeah,
you know,
obviously.
I'm actually going to miss some of his politically incorrect jokes. But more, on a more serious note, right, the Pfizer vaccine, which he took 3 months ago, allegedly, I mean, some people saying that they didn't believe that the royal family took them anyway. We've got, if he'd have read the little piece of paper on the side of that Pfizer vaccine, first of all, he would have seen that he was part of a Mengele-style human experiment, which won't be completed until 2023. This is an experimental vaccine that he's had injected into himself. And that so far in the UK, we've had 1,567 reported cardiac disorders of people after taking the Pfizer vaccine. This is something you can find out through what's called the yellow card reports. And there are 3 to 6 of those per 1,000 doses of both the different vaccines. So there is this system by which adverse effects of vaccines can be being reported. But I can tell you, from speaking to journalistic colleagues, and there is an enormous amount of editorial pressure on people not to report adverse effects of vaccines. So there are perfectly reasonable stories, even press releases going to newspapers, and they're saying, well, this is not the right story. So they're just spiking it. Basically, they just decide they're not going to print that story. And speaking to journalists that actually themselves have written stories that have never made it into the paper because it's not what the editor and supposedly the readers and listeners want to hear. I mean, this is really using news as a way of just being a PR machine for the pharmaceutical industry. So 1,567 reported cardiac disorders of the Pfizer and 43 deaths here in Britain, Martin, maybe 44. I mean, this is the one thing I would say about this is that, you know, he was taken ill immediately after having, well, very soon, 2 weeks or so after having the vaccine, in hospital for a while, and now he's died. So it may have had contributed.
Well, it may have done. I don't know. Of course, people should be objectively assessing the various vaccines. What's actually happening, of course, is that there is now a struggle to control the vaccine market, if you can call it that, on global level, with you know, the Chinese using their Sinopharm and the Russians using
it's a very dirty fight, isn't it?
Well, but it's being approached in a different way by different sides. I've sent you the article this week about the AstraZeneca vaccine, and the Oxford University team that had developed it wanted to make it an open patent so that anybody could produce it anywhere in the world. But the government here decided that they weren't going to do that, and they brought in AstraZeneca, which is basically a Swedish firm, to produce it, and they required, you know, they wanted to do it for a profit. And, of course, the Pfizer vaccine is the most expensive of all, and it's the most experimental of all as well, because it's not actually a traditional vaccine at all. And you saw the US putting pressure on the Brazilian government not to buy Sputnik vaccines, but to take the more expensive Pfizer vaccines.
Yeah, I mean, in other words,
but there's an interest here, where I'm driving at, to cut a long story short, is that apart from the general disbelief about vaccines and what, you know, and scepticism and so on, there's a situation where discrediting the other side's vaccines is definitely part of the war game.
It certainly is. Now, this article you sent me says the headline is "Poor Nations Are Left Reeling After Bill Gates Advised Oxford to Ditch Open Source COVID Vaccine." This is on Mint Press News. Unable to secure a profit in immunizing poorer nations, Western multinationals, including Oxford's private partner AstraZeneca, have prioritized those who can pay the most. So this is really just a quiet ditching of the idea that this is some kind of collaborative effort for the good of humanity. No, no, no. It's just about profit. And we've seen these amazing loads of stories the last 3 or 4 weeks about AstraZeneca, loads of questions being asked by even by journalists, amazingly, about whether they're true or not, saying that it's a 0.006% chance of having some blood clot from the AstraZeneca vaccine, and yet they ditched it anyway. It does start to look as if the news agencies and the regulators, in this case the European regulators and other regulators, are just simply being used as political pawns in order to fight back, because many of the people right across, particularly across Europe, are requesting to have the AstraZeneca vaccine as against the Pfizer one because they don't trust these mRNA vaccines, Martin.
Yeah, well, I know somebody who went to be inoculated and they asked what vaccine it was, and when told it was the Pfizer one, they said that they didn't want it and they'd come back, and they made a big fuss about it. Because, of course, if you're in a country where you've spent quite a lot of money on buying Pfizer vaccines and they're substantially more expensive than any of the others, then, of course, you don't want people turning their nose up at them, because they then go to waste and you've wasted the money. So, in other words, there are general scientific questions about vaccines and how quickly they can be developed safely. And also, of course, whether they work. You know, it may well turn out that all these vaccines, as the disease mutates, will become ineffective, which is another issue. But, of course, underlying all of this, it's very clear that the Western pharmaceutical industry, which is driven primarily by super profits, which they get from controlling patents, and it's an incredibly profitable industry if you can control the patents on something that people have to have and that governments are obliged to buy for their own people. It's a license to print money. But of course, what the Chinese and the Russians are trying to do by developing their independent state-developed vaccines and then go out to the developing world, particularly the Chinese, because they can manage without vaccines because they've basically controlled COVID within their borders, so they can concentrate on trying to help others. The Russians, of course, have got to, if Sputnik is important to them because they've got to deal with their own people. But, of course, various European countries, including the Germans, are starting to think, well, actually, we could probably buy Sputnik in from the Russians at much cheaper prices.
That's exactly what the Austrians have done. They've brought a load of the Sputnik vaccine, and they stuck two fingers up to Brussels and said, we've decided this on medical grounds and we don't care what you say.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Brussels, in fact, doesn't actually control ultimately what individual governments decide to do about this. So, yeah, there is a vaccine war going on out there, which, if you think about it, given all of the suffering and misery that this has caused, is extraordinary. I mean, it should be obvious that we should just work together as a species to put our brains together and come up with the best stuff.
Well, definitely.
What's going on, is it?
That's not at all. And we've had it quite clearly over the last couple of weeks from a former Pfizer respiratory diseases chief, retired now, Dr. Mike Yeadon, that he doesn't believe that anybody who's under 60 and healthy needs or should have a vaccine, or anyone that's already had COVID should have a vaccine, simply because it's not necessary, it's not needed, and it's likely to interfere with the workings of your own immune system. Obviously, if you've already had COVID and recovered from it, you don't need a vaccine. This is just basic stuff that all immunologists seem to know up until March last year, when everyone said, oh, the vaccine is going to be the knight in shining armor charging over the horizon to save everybody's souls. But anyway, whilst I was going to do this in the second hour, but I think we may as well charge into talking about COVID now, Martin. The London doctor has described the unprecedented level of sickness after COVID injection. Now, you won't be reading this in any of the national dailies or seeing it on BBC or Sky or on the radio because of the various guidelines that have been put out and rules Ofcom have put out, etc. And what it's saying is that there is a massive suppression of the sickness after people have after they've had the COVID injection. The doctor and consultant wrote that she was struggling to understand the failure to report the reality of the morbidity caused by our current vaccination program within the health service and the staff population. Well, basically, that people are afraid of losing their jobs if they start saying, well, actually, these vaccines aren't very good for people. There's a lot of people coming back sick. In a strongly worded letter to the British Medical Journal, a London-based consultant has pointed to the unprecedented levels of staff sickness following the COVID-19 injections, describing the coercion and mandating of the injection as reminiscent of a Nazi dystopia. Published on April the 2nd in the British Medical Journal, the letter came from Dr. K. Polyakova, a consultant in London, in response to a BMJ article entitled "Do Doctors Have to Have the COVID-19 Vaccine?" The journal did not provide further background for Polyakova. The original article strongly argued for the widespread uptake of the injections by medical staff, declaring there was a moral duty to do so in order to safeguard public health, as well as downplaying any concerns which might be raised about the efficacy or safety of the injection, which, by the way, of course, is an experimental vaccine. It's not been tested properly, and you're still in an experiment if you're having it. The blithe tone of the BMJ's article and the uniform opinions of the four medics cited raised concerns for Dr. Polyakova. She wrote that she was struggling to understand the failure to report the reality of the morbidity caused by our current vaccination program within the health service and staff population. Levels of sickness after vaccination is unprecedented, and staff are getting very sick, and some with neurological symptoms, which are having a huge impact on the health service function. Even the young and healthy are off for days, some for weeks, and some requiring medical treatment. Whole teams are being taken out as they went to get vaccinated together. So anyway, I'll put a link up to this article and this letter on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But would you agree, Martin, that there may be some actual real genuine suppression of this side of the story, with many media outlets under pressure to sell the vaccine effectively?
Yeah, I think the justification that will be made for this in the powers in the corridors of power is that it's really important that we don't muddy the message here. And of course, from the government's political point of view, they really want this vaccine dash for vaccination to work. So you'll see that people like Ian Duncan Smith and others who've been very, very critical of lockdowns are desperate for this vaccination to work, because if it's dangerous, A, or B, it doesn't work, which is what I suspect, then the only really option is the Chinese option, which is more lockdowns.
Well, the vaccines are going to do something, quite clearly. I think, I mean, their main motive is they desperately want to get the R rate down. And they've noticed that if you vaccinate loads of people, not only do the big pharmaceutical industry lobby stop hassling you, but you're much less likely to have the virus able to spread. But having said that, the same would happen if there is some sort of form of herd immunity with lots and lots of young people having caught it. So you do wonder if much of this is just motivated by profit. Anyway, look, before we get too far away from Prince Philip, I thought I'd dig out what I thought at the time. Now, this is a few years ago. I played this on the show when we were on Bristol Community Radio, who've ditched us, funnily enough, just before the mayor elections, which is where Marvin Rees, the Blairite Labour mayor, tries to get re-elected here in Bristol. And our station manager, Pat Hart, is one of his bosom buddies. And the board of BCFM decided that there was no case to answer. Of course, he can just drop my programme for his buddy, Pat Hart. No problem at all. So let's have a listen now to our first clip of this week, which is about the NHS. And this is Prince Philip talking in the 1980s about why he thinks that you're not allowed to criticise the NHS. Obviously, what he's implying here is he would rather like to criticise them.
The sacred cows, those are things that you daren't talk about, I mean, daren't criticise, put it that way, because they're elevated in the public mind. They've got a sort of status which is simply unassailable, and therefore you must on no account say anything about them. the obvious sacred cow is, let's say, the National Health Service, because it, I mean, it is there, and you're probably much safer not to say anything about it.
I just thought it's quite funny the way he's saying it is there, as if he would love it to just wither, Martin.
Well, isn't it interesting that when he had to go into hospital to have operations and so on, he went to National Health Service hospitals, and then for all the recovery and stuff, they've all got private health care. But of course, the private health care doesn't cover the important stuff. And so they've got one foot in both camps, really. And of course, yeah, like many people of his social group, the National Health Service concept is, distasteful to them.
Why is that?
Well, because it's basically, as conceived by Nye Bevan when he originally put it together, it's a massive foothold of socialist ideology in the heart of the capitalist society. I mean, if you give everybody free healthcare and do it properly, that takes a substantial chunk of the profitability out of health provision from the point of view of private providers. And it also gives people, from their point of view, an entirely, who do they think they are, free healthcare? They'll be asking for wage increases next, you know.
Well, the other thing, of course,
it's a very powerful mechanism for showing people why socialism works.
Yes, exactly. And what I'm saying is that there are other areas of society people can very clearly see, well, if they use this same philosophy in, say, transport, if they use this philosophy in energy, if they use this philosophy in banking, you know, that our society would be a hell of a lot easier, and that we wouldn't be being exploited day after day, and we wouldn't have a ridiculous...
That is why the Tory party opposed the NHS when it was first created and continued to oppose it until Churchill died. And then eventually they learned that they got to accept it because it was so popular and clearly effective. But they basically have always desired to destroy it. And you can see plenty of people in the current Tory leadership in government who basically do not like the idea of the NHS, at the same time as they've learnt to cover this with a fulsome praise of the NHS when it suits them, although they won't give nurses an inflation pay rise. But at the same time, of course, the Serco test and trace fiasco, billions wasted, they made sure that it was called NHS test and trace, even though it wasn't, in fact, NHS at all, because they basically got crafty about the way they're proceeding in order to break it up.
Don't you also think, though, that this pandemic or plandemic, whatever you want to call it, that has been used as a way to basically knife the NHS? So the idea, really, I mean, you know, it's becoming increasingly impossible to get a doctor's appointment, much more so since the beginning of the pandemic, for all sorts of reasons. My doctor actually saying to me, oh, well, this, I'm afraid, is going to be the new normal now, where you can't actually just go and book an appointment. You have to go through some sort of hoopla system on the internet before they'll even think about giving you an appointment. And then it would probably just be a phone call. And even the doctor, my doctor herself said, well, it's not really adequate. We need to see people face-to-face if we're going to make a proper diagnosis. I can't really tell what's going on if I'm just... And she was also saying that quite a lot of the people she speaks to on the phone, well, they just have to rebook it as a proper appointment for someone to come in, and it can be 3 or 4 weeks down the line. So what we're seeing is the pandemic being used as an excuse to even further reduce the services that people are getting through the NHS, and massive long delays, forcing people to go to A&E health service, which we know really since David Cameron came to power in 2010, every year, every winter has been in total crisis, and nothing's really been done to fix that at all.
Well, the Lansley reforms in 2012 have a lot to answer for, because if you remember, David Cameron was still in his hugger hoodie stage, and he was saying that there will be no top-down reform of the health service. Now, people should have listened carefully there, because he said no top-down reform, but what he actually was planning with the American healthcare companies and the advisors that they provide is that there was going to be a bottom-up reform. That is to say that GPs' practices were all going to be turned into little businesses, and that's effectively what's happened. And they compete with each other for customers, and they try to lower the price of supply. And of course, what actually happened is various conglomerates took over managing the affairs. I mean, we've got US private healthcare firms who are now managing, you know, whole strings of GP partnerships, which used to be a completely, you know, they were separate from the NHS, but they were basically not functioning as businesses. And that, of course, was what was wrong. And of course, you've now seen the government saying that they're going to go, that they've realised that the problem is there isn't enough joined up planning, and that we're going to go back to a system similar to what was created, what was before the Lansley reforms, but it'll be run by the minister and not by the NHS bureaucrats. In other words, they want more scope to be able to, you know, to create contracts for private businesses. And don't forget, ultimately, that if you're going to have a system of where the government basically takes responsibility for people's health, the government can either organise that itself, or it can contract it out, as has always happened to some extent, to private businesses. And I think that the right wing of the Tory party are now coming round to the idea that we're going to have spend lots of money on health and what have you, and that the magic money tree will provide the cash, as long as it goes into their pockets and the pockets of their mates.
Yep. And it's a similar thing, of course, that's been going on in education, Martin, isn't it, which is where you work. The idea that you've got these little trusts around the country that are scooping up various schools, and the idea that head teachers are running things in the public interest with direct funding from the public is out the window. So anyway, a lot of these changes have been being encouraged, of course, by Labour, particularly Gordon Brown and starting the private finance initiatives. And, you know, there is this Mandelsonian Blairite wing of the Labour Party, which, of course, is running Bristol now with the bullying claims again and again. And Joe Sargent just being the latest Labour councillor to resign, having been bullied for months and months by the Labour leadership here in Bristol. But I thought we'd look at a new party which is standing in London. It's called Let London Live. The guy behind it is Jeremy Corbyn's brother, Piers Corbyn, who seems to be in the news quite a lot. And I managed to grab an interview with him this week in between. He seemed to be going for the Guinness Book of Records as having the more arrests than anybody else over the anti-lockdown stuff. But here he is talking about the anti-lockdown, anti-mask and anti-vaccine platform. He's standing in London, and whether he really stands a chance of either himself or some of the people who are standing to be members of the London Assembly under the Let London Live banner actually getting elected in May.
I started off in Glastonbury doing little rallies and demonstrations around Glastonbury Town Centre Cross. It was about six of us, and the police would turn up and usual move on, do this, do that, and fixed penalty notices and all that nonsense. Then I there were some things going on in London, but not very much, but I decided to go back to London to join them and see if we could get things moving there. And then we did step by step. But we tried to think of anything we could to get people to understand that what they were suffering was part of something bad, and therefore they ought to join our movement to stop these wrongs happening on us. And one of the things which worked very well was our drink against the COVID con thing. It's when they said pubs had to close early and stuff like that. So we deliberately went outside them and drunk and danced and played music outside them and so forth. And that got a lot of support. But other things we've been doing, anti-masking actions, walking around with a big poster saying, you don't need to mask, you just, if you're upset, you don't need to. And we produced a little card showing people they don't need to mask, an exemption card, which is very useful and very popular among youth, especially young girls who don't want to be masked up but want to show their faces. Other things we've done, of course, is demonstrate outside, we demonstrated about lots of buildings, but we went one outside the National Education Union to say to them, look, you people are involved in mental torture of children and you should end it. and given out leaflets outside schools, which have got a lot of interest. And that issue is now getting a lot of traction. And we're hoping to work on that. So join together all the different ways in which people are being hammered by the COVID story. And the movement now, I could say, there's at least 100,000 people around the country who are willing to take action of some sort and have turned up on demonstrations. So, because a lot of them don't all travel all the way, there must be probably 500,000 people who are really clearly on our side on this. Now, that is not a majority of the population, but we are making headway. And when we interact with people now, it's getting a bit easier. There are some people, though, who are more brainwashed than ever. There's a hardcore of people who are seriously brainwashed and difficult to get through to.
So when you are out on the streets,
vaccine, they might listen.
Yeah, when you're out on the streets, Piers, do you ever get people haranguing you, you know, sort of having a go?
To an extent, yes. Generally speaking, on our election campaigns, we've had very good reception. I'm not joking. I mean, people are there saying, we're really glad you're doing this. We don't want the current mayor. He's wasted our time. He's caused joblessness. But when we make speeches, we do get attacked sometimes. We've had two physical attacks in the last 2 weeks. One of them in Uxbridge, I'm speaking on the megaphone, and I started saying the BBC was spreading, you know, false propaganda. And this guy just attacked me, just ran towards me with his fist, trying to, I don't know, knock the megaphone out of my hand, I think. But he was intercepted by somebody. And then we had a similar type of thing, not quite so ferocious, in Hyde Park, Speaker's Corner, when we were speaking on a megaphone on the grass at Speaker's Corner.
Well, it's a lot of effort you're putting in, but actually, yes. Let London Live doesn't really stand a chance of getting anywhere in these London elections, does it?
Well, it does, yes, because we have a message which people understand when they know it. Question is getting through to them. And furthermore, we're the only ones with anybody of any numbers on the ground doing anything. The Labour Party's active base of campaigners doesn't seem to be there at all. I mean, I haven't seen any of them anywhere. And normally at this stage, they would be giving out leaflets. So they're relying on just deliveries through the post and whatever they can get on the media. Our social media campaign is stepping up right now. So seriously, we could win. I know you're difficult to believe. We were 1,000-1 against yesterday and we're 250-1 against today. If we carry on at that rate of change, we'll be miles ahead soon. But
do you stand a chance of actually getting members of the Assembly or not? I mean,
yes,
obviously,
yeah.
Mayor is the top prize, but what about some of the smaller cherries?
Oh, yeah. We should certainly get on in terms of the list. We should get enough percentage in the list, and on top of the list, our list candidates.
So how does that work? Just explain for people.
Well, people have three votes in these London mayor elections, or four in a way. You've got a vote for the mayor, and for that you have two votes. You have your first choice and your second choice. Then for your assembly representative in these super constituencies, and there's 14 of them in London, which comprise about two or three boroughs each, we have candidates, not in all of these super constituencies, but some of them. And then and you have a vote for a constituency candidate, and you also have a vote for your party list. So you say, the party list I want is X, and you put a tick, I let London Live. And if those get and then they're shared out among all the lists and the votes. So some of those votes, like the, well, I don't know, the Dustbin Boniface or whatever he's called, won't get anywhere. But, you know, we should get a substantial percentage there. Because we're getting support everywhere. I'll tell you, it's quite surprising. You know, people come to us, yes, Piers, we're glad you're standing. We want you. We're going to vote for you.
What about your legal position, though? Because I know that you've had all sorts of things like fines, being arrested,
several.
Looked like you were going for the Guinness Book of Records at one point. But what's going on with your legal cases? Because it would be very sad if, you know, you were jailed or something and you couldn't take up your job as mayor.
Yeah, that's a fair point. But back onto the figures, When my brother stood for leader of the Labour Party, he was 400-1 against at the start, and he won. So, you know, the right campaign, because we're not lockdown light, for example, and he defeated all those Tory light candidates. I mean, we have clarity, which others don't have. So there we are. But back to being jailed or whatever. No, there's nothing there that they can jail me for. You see, the arrests are quite a low-level sort of thing. They're all about fines. We're not going to pay any fines. True, if I don't pay a fine, I could go to prison instead, which is something we have to think about. But currently, they're backing off these big £10,000 fine, and they keep adjourning cases or not having them or dropping them. Of the 15 arrests, we've dealt with, I think, about six of them. We've had two in court. One was a conditional, sorry, an absolute discharge. Another one was no case to answer. And then they've dropped the Sheffield ones and a couple of others. What about that make? I don't know where we got to now on the 15, but they have, and the leafleting one, that complete nonsense, the police have dropped that. They know there's nothing in there at all. So, you know, they're trying to adjourn various things, but they're never going to lead to prison.
And what about in Bristol? Because I know you came to Bristol, you basically started to speak, and this is last, November. And just as you started to speak, a whole load of police turned up and threw you in the back of a van. So how's that all going?
Well, that is going to, I'm going to appear at Bristol Magistrates Court on the 22nd of April. So I'm looking forward to seeing you there, Tony.
Okay.
That'll be fun. I mean, you know, we can make a little speech, talk to people, have a bit of rallying about whatever we've got to do. But again, they're just going through a process hoping to intimidate others, but it's not working. But it's important that I've been resisting systematically, you see. Although we paid a lot of money to barristers and so forth, getting an absolute discharge on the first case of its kind was really quite significant. So people realise, well, okay, it ain't such a big deal after all, is it? So people have been more willing after that to face the police. And no one needs to get arrested anyway, because the number of people who get arrested on any one of these demos is less than half of 1%. I mean, you know, if you don't want to be arrested, just don't walk to the front.
Okay, so you're now standing against your brother's own party in London. Yeah. What do you make of the Labour Party since Jeremy departed?
Well, he hasn't, of course, departed. He's been shoved aside and declared he's not a member of the Labour group of MPs, which is a disgrace. But I would say the Labour Party, as it is now, has completely lost its right to represent the working class and does not do so. Because people we meet in anywhere, Southall, Tower Hamlets, Camden, whatever, they all say the same thing. We do not want Sadiq Khan back, and Labour doesn't represent us anymore. You see, what are they? They're trying now to be a national government along with Keir Starmer. So, you know, my brother, who wouldn't have truck with those things because of the economic strictures that would go with that. Even if he goes along with lockdown, you know, he's not the sort of person they want as a fellow traveller. So they want him out, out, out. And that means the Labour Party is just going to retract into a shell.
What about your own party, though? Because I know that we've had a Labour Party councillor up in Manchester actually endorsing you, which is a bit strange. I wonder how long he'll keep his job.
Well, he's a Labour councillor, been there for 2 years. A great guy. Omar Ahmed is his name. He's Muslim by, he's not especially religious, but he is a Muslim, for example. And I would say he's quite representative of the base of support which Sadiq Khan thinks he's got. But I would say that is the base of support Sadiq Khan has now lost and is losing daily. So I think in a couple of weeks' time, Sadiq Khan will be spending all his time chasing his base. And he won't turn up to other parts of London other than certain areas where he thinks he's going to get his support. Bristol, the 22nd of April. And whatever happens there, I will be glad to join in.
So that's Piers Corbyn speaking to me the other day about his new party, Let London Live. Martin, would you agree with him on some of his analysis of what's going on with Labour? He's obviously quite close to his brother, although he doesn't have all the same views, thank God. You know, he's saying effectively that the modern version of the Labour Party that is represented in the these local elections, it will be a big test, particularly also, of course, in the Hartlepool by-election. He doesn't think they're going to do very well because they're losing contact with their the working class base. I think that's basically what he's saying there.
Well, I think there's definitely some truth in all of that. I think it's interesting, isn't it, that in these mayoral elections and local elections to the Assembly in London, you've actually got a form of proportional representation, which, of course, means that there's a much more open field than you would otherwise be the case.
Yeah, this means that brand new parties and new candidates actually do stand a chance.
Yeah, they stand a chance, but that's because ultimately they can, with their transfer votes in terms of the mayor, and also, what may happen with something like this, they're going to have to reach a certain proportion of votes to get people elected onto the list. And this is going to be a problem for Alex Salmond in Scotland, because if he doesn't reach the 5% necessary to get his candidates from the Alba Party in on the list, then the people who vote for him will basically be undermining the SNP. Now, that's a quirk of the Scottish setup.
Well, I don't think Alex Salmond would particularly mind that. But, of course, the same was true.
Because the point is that those votes, if you don't reach the 5%, all those votes are wasted.
Martin, the same was true in the European Parliament elections, wasn't it, where Nigel Farage is able to come along with a thing called the Brexit Party out of the blue, basically, and do very well in those. And this is something that you were saying, I think, was it last week, that Priti Patel is trying to roll this whole proportional system.
Yeah, well, they've suddenly realised that given the direction of travel of the government, they can't allow all of this proportional voting. Now, they can't stop it in Scotland and in Wales. It's embedded, but they can stop it in relation to mayoral elections in England.
And what about Northern Ireland?
That's what Priti Patel has said she's going to do. Incidentally, can I just mention before I forget, Tony, that Momentum, this is quite significant, Momentum have decided that they are now in favour of proportional representation and that they're pushing the Labour Party towards support for proportional representation. That is quite significant. I think it's a result of what's been happening and Keir Starmer's rather authoritarian approach. Eventually, Momentum have had an internal vote and quite a few Labour councillors and councils around the country are now coming out in favour of PR. And I think it's about time.
Just going back to Prince Philip for a second. Sorry, folks, but looking at these yellow card figures, I'm quite surprised to see that when it comes to the four most important types of illness reported after having the Pfizer vaccine, that the cardiac disorders and deaths are the second highest of the side effects. So, the more I look at this, the more I look at the figures, and this is up online. I'll put a link on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's all up on the government website for journalists, please, if there are any out there, to actually read what the side effects of the Pfizer vaccine are. And I think there's actually been even more reporting of the AstraZeneca side effects of that. But anyway, look, the whole problem, going back to the story about with Piers Corbyn, do you think he stands a chance of getting any of the Let London Live people? Because we've seen these massive rallies in London. People just, there's two sides to this, as I see it, Martin. You've got people who are fed up with the lockdowns and don't believe in them. And then there's another side, particularly of young people. And we've seen this massively going on here in Bristol with the Kill the Bill protests, who are just fed up with the what they see as an establishment older generation who have left them with no future. I mean, it's really, you know, Sex Pistol territory, that they don't have job prospects. They don't have income prospects. They're being, you know, told that it's very unlikely that they're going to ever be able to have somewhere of their own to live. This is threatening their marriage prospects and all sorts. So young people are just simply angry and looking for an excuse, maybe, and in fact, in Northern Ireland too, to come out on the streets and make a fuss about it.
Yeah, I think we've got to separate out the various causes that people might or might not want to protest about. I mean, as you're probably aware, anybody who listens to the show, I'm not really an anti-lockdown person. But I think certain things, like when they're bringing in draconian legislation against peaceful protest, then lockdown or no lockdown, people have got to protest.
Well, let's be clear here. It's under cover of the lockdown that this legislation is coming through.
Well, it's very naughty of them, isn't it? Not. To bring that forward.
Well, they think it's clever. They think it's cheeky. They think it's smart of them.
Yeah, but it's actually incredibly provocative and stupid. And ultimately, you know, I don't necessarily agree with Piers Corbyn's views, but there should have been, from the get-go, an understanding that demonstrations and protests would have to be excluded from lockdown measures. And that means you can have close the pubs, you can do all sorts of things in a lockdown, but you can't stop people having political protests. They should have put that in there at the very beginning. And so therefore there shouldn't be any ambiguity about it. If people, as long as they pursue, you know, as long as they do certain things that they're supposed to do, they should be allowed to have political protests.
Again, this
is an
area. Of
course, they are now legal again.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that they find.
In this area. You know, politics and medical measures do not mix at all. In fact, the more the closer they get, the more people seem to die.
Well, I mean, the decisions about what to do about medical emergencies are political decisions. And there may be a decision to do whatever. I mean, it depends what the emergency
is. Are they supposed to be scientific decisions, not political?
They are indeed, but they're also ultimately not made just by scientists. They have to be made by the political leadership, on the advice of scientists. And that means that you've got to allow political debate, and including going to the streets, in order for that to be accepted. And I would argue that all political protests should be allowed, whatever the level of the lockdown measures are in place, because you've got to allow people a voice to say what they think about what's going on.
And what do you make of these Labour councillors endorsing Piers Corbyn's party? Should Keir Starmer give them the boot?
Well, they've broken the Labour Party rule book, so I imagine they will be expelled from the party. It's quite simple. Maybe, Tony Blair should be expelled from the party for being a war criminal. Not that he will be, ha-ha.
But I mean, surely the idea here is they'll look at things like this and say, well, actually, this is just going to draw more attention to it, and we don't want that if we expel the guy.
No, I think that the feeling I get at the moment is that the Starmer faction, if I may call it that, are quite happy for people to call them out and say they're opposed to them, because by calling for endorsing, for example, support for other parties. That has always been against the Labour rule book. And of course, they're quite happy to kick people out, and they're quite happy for people to flounce out as well. The Starmer strategy seems to be to use the mainstream media and the party paid apparatus to try and win over swing voters in marginal constituencies, which voted Tory last time, get them back into the red column, and then that's the way forward. But I think, as you mentioned, the Hartlepool by-election earlier, I think that's going to be a humiliation for Starmer. That was always clear that the Tories were probably going to win it. And so all of his attempts to be more Tory than the Tories will just do him no good.
But isn't,
if you're going to vote Tory,
this,
might as well vote Tory.
I mean, this is exactly
people don't vote for the Tory light, do they?
This is exactly what Peter Mandelson's plan is, surely, to make the Labour Party opposition.
To my mind, it's absolutely idiotic.
Yeah, but it's
no way
the
you
idea.
That way.
This is the Peter Mandelson plan, is to make sure that the Labour Party is no opposition whatsoever to Boris.
Well, the guy who's standing in Hartlepool for the Labour Party, and it used to be Peter Mandelson's constituency, is exactly of that kind of ilk. He's a Mandelsonite Labour stroke Tory, and it won't work. The Tories are going to win because they're going to pick up the people who voted for the Brexit Party at last election, and there's quite a substantial chunk of them. And the problem is that these people you can't out Tory the Tories.
No,
there was a study being done recently of the electorate in that constituency. You know, they've done an opinion survey, and it looks pretty clear that Labour are going to lose. But surprisingly enough, a lot of the Tory voters or first-time Tory voters want to renationalise the railways, believe in the NHS, want to raise taxes on the wealthy, and all of the actual policies that, you know, the people in places like that want are actually Corbynite policies. But of course, Corbyn was poisoned to them because he's from Islington, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it was the Remain, Martin. One of these days, you're going to have to face up to it. It was his failure to deal with the Israel lobby in his own party, but mainly it was his failure to deal with the Remainer,
Remainers are a majority.
Remainers in his own party. If you can't deal with the Remainers in your own party and the Israel lobby, then you're going to lose the election.
How can he do that? Jeremy Corbyn was elected overwhelmingly by young people who joined the party. I've been a party member since 1975, but I know loads of people around here who joined the party to vote for him, and they all voted overwhelmingly.
Well, vote. You know, he's got to play not to his members, but he's got to play to the voters.
Well, indeed, also what he should have done is what Momentum have just done. He should have come out in favour of PR as soon as he was elected.
Well, I know you were asking him about that yourself, weren't you, when he was here in Bristol?
The New Zealand back row.
You were asking him about that yourself when you were here in Bristol.
Well, but anyway, let's
go on to look at the Police and Crime Commissioner elections, and I think very, very important issue here. We've got the horrific situation where we've got a police and crime bill, sentencing and courts bill, which I just call the police state bill, which is has the potential to criminalise up to 20,000 people in the Bristol area, people that cannot afford to pay the rent or a mortgage, and are trying to find some other place, sort their housing out by one means or another, whether it be through a vehicle dweller, travellers, or, you know, through squatting. There's always some other way. If you can't pay the rent and you can't find anywhere to live, we're in the middle of the biggest housing crisis since the Second World War. And the Conservatives' answer to this is to, or Priti Patel specifically, is to turn them into criminals. Maybe they just want to stick them in prisons and labour camps and get them to make indicator sticks for BMW cars and things like that for nothing, you know, forced labour, that sort of thing. Or maybe they want to deport them somewhere, who knows? But to criminalise the poor seems to be the policy here. And this is one of the things that makes it quite important that we've got a decent chief constable. And Andy Marsh, our existing chief constable, announced he's going to be resigning this week, which came after a ruling by the law lords that the fraud going on allegedly at, I'm not even sure we have to say allegedly anymore, but I will, at the business support unit in Castle Park here in Bristol, Lloyds Bank, that there is enough evidence to prosecute. The law lords have just decided, which goes against everything that Avon and Somerset Police have been advising for the last 5 years. So it's great to see that the legal system is finally coming to Portishead and saying, when are you going to prosecute these people? You've got to do it now. Also, of course, Sue Mount-Stevens is the so-called independent police and crime commissioner here, who happened to be married to the boss of the West of England Chamber of Commerce, known as Business West. So she wasn't very independent, really. And amazingly, it's the assistant chief constable who comes in for so much criticism by the law lords and also by the victims of Lloyds Bank. He is also standing as an independent. It would be amazing chutzpah if he was to get in, having been responsible for partly for the cover-up of the crimes going on. So to me, this is like a battle royal, Martin, between the bankers in Castle Park who are getting away with fraud time after time, It's described by some of the victims as the abattoir, where various people were just sent there to have their businesses stolen off them and their farms ripped off them, and were left, you know, penniless on the side of the streets in debt, when actually what had been happening to them was a fraud, very much like the fraud going on at HBOS, which was prosecuted, I think it was in 2017, which was also bought up by Lloyds, wasn't it? But it took years and years to get them into court. Hopefully we'll see these business support people, unit people who've been doing things like forging signatures, etc., see them brought to court. Anyway, I did quite a long interview with Trevor, and I'll put the full version up on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk. Trevor Melam runs something called Action for Justice, and he's a particularly interesting chap because back in his days running this massive estate agency, multi-million pound business, he was actually an advisor to central government on property fraud, and he used to go up there once a month and talk to them about it. Anyway, so he talks about that in the longer interview, but let's have a clip now about what he makes of the candidates that are standing in the PCC election, the Police and Crime Commissioner election in May, to take charge of overseeing the police of Avon and Somerset, and that is basically their job. So what about the Lloyds Bank BSU fraud? How does that play out in this election for Police and Crime Commissioner? I asked Trevor Melam.
So I think Mark would do a very, very good job, and we will soon be passing some evidence to him, along with MPs and Mr. Stansfield over at Thames Valley. And we've also I've also spoke quite in depth with Kerry Barker. Kerry was a criminal barrister. I've shown him on a double Zoom a lot of what we've got. I pointed out 2006 Fraud Act, 68 Theft Act, bait and switch, and Kerry said, "You've missed conspiracy to defraud." I said, I didn't get that far. I was going to say it. But, you know, so the good thing is, and again, we're going to be passing over a lot of records to Kerry. So if Kerry gets in or Mark get in, they are going to, you know, we will hold them to account. We will protest in their meetings. But the thing is, they both sound quite decent chaps. And, you know, we wouldn't be passing evidence over to them. I've got about 1,700 pages that will go to them, which is 60 victims' cases. And we've got another 20 on top of that. They will also be going to Priti Patel because she's ultimately responsible under the Police Reform Social Responsibility Act for the success and failure. And sadly, it's the failure of the police.
Well, I wouldn't hold your breath with Priti Patel, Trevor.
Well, I'm afraid she hasn't got a choice. Like I say, the thing I used to do, I used to look at cracks in legislation. So I don't care what people say. I know what the legislation and regulation says, and I know what the Bill of Rights says and the separation of powers. You've also got contempt of Parliament, and, you know, Parliament is sovereign. It's above the square mile legislation, and it has to protect the British people. People have just forgotten that. The law is there if people actually use it. And I'm afraid this is one that we've got overwhelming evidence, and it will be passed to the Cabinet, and it will be passed to Priti Patel. And if she doesn't deal with it, then as happened with Matt Hancock, we will then look to take the matter further. But I hope Priti Patel would do the right thing. Priti Patel also, in the 2014, in a Westminster debate, she knew about this. She commented about it. She's got knowledge of circumstance and in her position. At the time, she was Secretary to the Exchequer. And she said, I'll give you the words she said. She said, she wrote this to one of our victims and said it in the debate. She said, "As you know, I'd refer this to the government department that is best placed to look into this matter." She commented about the Avon and the Somerset police failure and that sort of thing. She then said, "My officials have engaged closely with the Home Office, which considers questions around fraud. I understand the Home Office has agreed to look into this in more detail." That was 6 years ago. So she now sits on the main seat. So we're going to say, well, how did that work out? So The thing is, she is responsible. She can't run away from this, and hopefully...
I understand. I mean, let's hope she doesn't. Anyway, look, Sue Mount Stevens stood as an independent, even though she was not entirely independent of the establishment, being married to one of the chairs of Business West. But John Smith is standing as an independent. He's the former Deputy Police and Crime Commissioner.
Yeah. So I think Mark and Kerry... either of them would make splendid police crime commissioners. And I think we've seen what happens when crooks run the police force and the crime commissioner's office. So is John Smith a crook? I'd say yes, John Smith is a crook.
Well, why do you say that?
Because of all the evidence I've got. Like I say, I've been in property for many, many years, and I've had 10 years consulting to government on property fraud and money laundering. And I've had 5-6 years looking at many of the victims' cases. John Smith is a crook. And if he wants to see me in court, please see me in court, Mr. Smith, because I've got overwhelming evidence here. And I think the other big thing, especially, I think the court wouldn't go very nicely on him because he was a lawyer. He was at Burgess Salmon.
In what way, Burgess Salmon and him, actually, you think implicit in some of this fraud then?
Well, like I say, we've got a lot of evidence here, and there's things I can say at the moment, things I can't say, but I really don't think that some of the people that we've been talking about would like this anywhere near a courtroom.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? And fascinating that he has the audacity to stand as police and crime commissioner if he's been very close to some of the people committing frauds.
If you want to cover something up, then, like I say, the trick that they normally do is try and take control. And, you know, I've seen a lot. I'm in Kent, but I've seen an awful lot what people say about Mrs. Mount Stevens and Mr. Smith, and you know, a lot of the comments I've got to agree with.
Well, Sue is not standing for re-election, and we've just heard this week that the Chief Constable Andy Marsh has had enough too.
Yep, good. Another bad egg that needs going. You know, totally corrupt. Totally corrupt. I mean, I've got paperwork here and a lot of their predecessors. I know there wasn't an earlier crime commissioner. Look, going back to Common Purpose hijacks budgets. The policing budget when the crime commissioners come in was $8 billion for the UK. You know, the other thing is you've got misappropriation of funds. And what we've got evidence of is we've got evidence that Avon and Somerset Police have covered up criminal fraud. You know, we've got letters here that say there's not enough evidence to go on. I've got a letter here that mentions Nick Gargan has made that decision on some bits. We've got Andy Smith letters.
So he's the former Chief Constable.
Yeah, he's the former Chief Constable. I've got tons of letters here from the victims. And when you bring all the bits together, it's you know, the picture on the puzzle becomes very clear. John Smith needs to try and get in to keep the frauds covered up. I mean, it's a bit concerning that when you even look at the mayor, and I put a thing on Twitter, the mayor is in with a company called Plimsoll, which is Productions. And they make some quite good TV. But the thing is, that mayor knows, because I know other victims we've got have written about Lloyds. And on the board of that company is LDC. You know, the mayor's aware of it, and he's not getting off of it. He's not even coming back to us to say, tell me more. That's a bit concerning, because a lot of these people are involved in big budgets of your county. And you've really got to say, where's the money go? I mean, on the police, you've not only got the Avon Somerset Police covering up criminal fraud, the law lords, we can say that now. It's not alleged on those cases. You know, the law lords have made their decision. They're higher than normal High Court judges. And I've got paperwork here that relates to those cases from your police farce that says not enough evidence and so on. Well, there was enough for the judges, maybe they'd just open their eyes. But the other thing is, you've got the audacity that Sue Mount Stevens and John Smith misled us victims into thinking there were going to be an independent investigation. And it wasn't. It was another whitewashing.
So he refers there to LDC. which the mayor is involved with, Marvin Rees. This is a private equity investment firm and involved in media production too. But also, he alleges involved with the Lloyds and with this fraud, with sharing directors and things like that. But anyway, it will certainly be interesting, Martin. I mean, you know, one of the things I put, and I'll put it, like I say, I'll link up to the longer interview with Trevor on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, is this idea that if things get really rotten, then you end up with organised crime actually running the criminal justice system.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not unusual at all if you go around the world. I mean, you know, the war on drugs in Mexico has led to a situation where the crime cartels are so powerful that they are able to buy law enforcement and politicians and make and break politicians, because politicians need money for elections and so on. And of course, they've also got intimate links with the intelligence services who, you know, claim their budgets from the US and so on the grounds that they're fighting the war on drugs. It's you know, the corruption is at every level in every jurisdiction. And it wouldn't be at all surprising if Britain, the money laundering capital of the world, shouldn't have its fair share of this stuff.
So what Trevor's basically saying is don't vote for the Independent in the Police and Crime Commissioner elections. And he represents 200 victims of Lloyds Bank. But either the Labour or the Conservative, he's spoken to, and he has confidence that they will do something about this. And there's no sense in living in a society which thinks it's OK to criminalise travellers and gypsies whilst letting fraudsters who are stealing farms through the financial system and businesses off of people, wrecking their lives, who've worked all their lives sometimes to build up a business, and then to find Lloyds Bank have just stolen it from them, and the police won't act. So that's not what we want the police for. We want the police to go and start investigating these people. And the big news, of course, is Andy Marsh stepping down too, quite likely, that this he has noticed that there has been this Lord's ruling against him and his force, and also likely that he may be thinking about the possibility that he and his officers got it completely wrong when they said that there was no case to answer. So it's always interesting to know, isn't it, you know, that there are influences behind a lot of the figures that we see. I mean, we talked, hidden interests, I suppose, vested interests, whether it's common purpose, which Marvin Rees and Sandy Hoare Rutherford, the Labour and Green mayors, are both part of or graduates of. And, you know, in this case, it's the Police and Crime Commissioner Sue Mount Stevens from the old Mount Stevens Bakery. Some people in this part of the world will remember those. She sold that bakery, and most of them were taken over by Greggs. That was her role in business, and she was very close to the business networks. And this is funny because, I mean, last week I remember mentioning as well that Business West, this organisation we keep hearing about, chaired by the Mandelsonian Blairite Labour Party member John Savage, also ex-master of the Merchant Venturers. He left the Labour Party when Jeremy Corbyn became leader, in inverted commas, disgust. He, of course, was running Business West, and the headquarters of Common Purpose was literally there, up at Lee Court, right next to Business West's headquarters, so he could have a little chit-chat with them. So, you know, this has been talked about, as we had Brian Gerrish a couple of weeks ago, with Kevin Cahill as a kind of a fifth column. Might be classed as conspiracy theories, Martin. I like to think of them more as investigative journalism, trying to figure out what networks may be behind various of these candidates that put on their ballot paper, "I'm an independent," or even, you know, they may be working for a particular party, but they've got other interests behind the scenes that they're playing rather close to their chest.
Well, it was ever thus. I mean, you know, it's the way of the world in a way. And you know, there are supposedly checks and balances to keep all this under control, but they're very limited. I think one of the big drivers, as we discussed some weeks ago about this, when we first broached this subject with your previous contributor, was that the banks were basically bankrupt in 2008. So Royal Bank of Scotland, for example, who were one of the most egregious offenders in this sort of thing, were going round basically snaffling up lots of businesses by predatory lending because they've got a great big hole in their balance sheet to fill. So, I mean, just general greed always encourages people to do things like this, but desperation really pushes them into action.
Yeah, and also the knowledge that their pals over at the police and the detectives that they're chummy with are not going to investigate them. That's also rather likely to encourage them.
Well, indeed. And it's you know, in the best run societies in the world, whatever, whoever they may be, these things are... you know, got to be guarded against, because that's the problem with greed. It's exponential, isn't it?
Okay, so anyway,
once you've lost money like a gambler, you've got to go back and try and win it back somehow. Otherwise, you're stuffed, aren't you?
Well, remember we had Rowan Bosworth Davis on many years ago, didn't we? He was. We got a little nasty little legal letter from Hargreaves Lansdown, which our boss Pat Hart took very, very seriously, which I laughed at, which was saying, oh, you can't say things like this. And my reply is, well, yes, you can, if it's true. And Rowan Bosworth Davis was saying that he had taken, is it Peter Hargreaves, I think it was, yeah, from Hargreaves Lansdown in three times for questioning over using clients' money for gambling, effectively. So he was taking clients' money and using insider tips in order to make more money out of it for himself and for his business. And then when the clients wanted their shares back or share certificates, only when they got really stroppy and demanded those share certificates would he actually use the money to buy those shares and give them a certificate. So he was committing an enormous amount of fraud, allegedly, and that was according to Rowan Bosworth Davis. But the more serious, in a way, was the charges that Rowan gave about what happened after the Blue Arrow case, where the word came down from on high, Martin, that absolutely no financial crimes would be prosecuted. That maybe, you know, a few token ones like Tom Hayes, Rain Man, might go to prison. People who weren't necessarily part of the elite club of the City of London and the senior bankers and executives would not be prosecuted. That was absolutely cast iron guaranteed, because the Blue Arrow case was an attempt by the fraud squad at the Met to make sure that the some of the blue blood bankers actually got went to jail, or, you know, that some of the most obvious criminals. And this was a rights issue back in, I think the case was 1992-93. And Rowan explained to us that the word came down from on high, no more prosecution for financial crime. So at that moment, surely, you know, the City of London officially, well, no, unofficially, but it turned into really the criminal financial capital of the world.
Yeah, and of course Rowan Bosworth Davis is now a criminologist as opposed to a police officer, and his, you know, his thesis was all about how the mainstream banking system has become organized crime, and it fulfills all of the criteria that you would think about organized criminals. And if you think about the interaction between the bank official banking system, things like the international drugs trade and the intelligence services and so on, it's pretty clear that they are. I remember Andy Marsh coming on the show when we were on BCFM and him listening quite in, you know, basically listening to all us talking about these sort of things. And he seemed to sort of understand what we were talking about. But of course, the other thing that's happened this week is it's been suggested that he's resigned because Priti Patel was not very happy with the way he chose to police the Colston demonstration this time last year, and also, of course, because of the mayhem the other Sunday outside Bridewell Police Station. That may be just a cover story. It may well be, as you say, that the thing he's most worried about is this stuff about the banks.
Well, and the ruling by the law lords, this is very serious, that saying that he's the reports that he's been saying that there isn't enough evidence to prosecute these people, well, is simply not true.
Well, it happens that his contract of service was going to run out in the summer anyway. So, you know, he's obviously made the decision that discretion is the better part of valor, and he's going to disappear. But, Yeah, interesting stuff, eh?
Anyway, and what do you make of these, the way that Andy Marsh has been dealing with these protests? I know you went along to the Black Lives Matter one where Colson's statue was toppled, Martin. Did you get a little secret tip?
Well, no, I think in actual fact the police on the day did a pretty good job. They could see that, well, there was overwhelming numbers of people. They probably realised what was going to happen. And they didn't not do anything. They videoed it from a distance. And four people, who are the main instigators, I presume, will are already, you know, put down for a trial in the Crown Court here, which they're going to, you know, they're going to plead not guilty on the basis of political convictions, whatever, and they will no doubt probably be convicted of criminal damage.
Well, you can't presume. We can't presume that. I mean, Martin, we certainly can't presume that. I mean, all we can say is that they are the alleged perpetrators. That's all we
all
can
right.
say.
The point I'm making is that the policing by the Bristol Police, I think, took the right decision on the day, which was that we're not going to have a big fight about this. It's hardly worth the bother. And, we will follow up if people have done anything bad. And, of course, they've got a lot more to follow up from what happened outside the police station the other week, Sunday evening, because people were basically doing dangerous stuff like setting police cars on fire with people in them. Now, that's not the same as knocking a statue down.
Martin, it's a lot of people saying that that may well be agents provocateurs.
Well, indeed, it might be. But I think the fact that they've got the people concerned means that we will have a court case about this and we can make our own judgment about whether it's agents provocateurs or just people acting off their own bat. I think it's incumbent on everybody to show common sense and restraint, whether you're a police officer or a demonstrator.
Yeah, the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, was in Bristol yesterday or the day before. I'm not quite sure which. But anyway, he's backing the Kill the Bill protest. There's another one happening tonight.
Well, I mean, the fact that he's backing them, I think, is quite interesting because initially, before what happened on Clapham Common, the word is that they were going to abstain on this bill, as they've abstained on the ridiculous bills which make the police service, the intelligence services and the military above the law. But I think what happened, because they saw what happened on Clapham Common and they realised, and of course the police in South London had basically decided not to intervene on that vigil, and lots of vigils did take place around the country and nothing happened and they all went home. Pretty Patel stuck her finger in and said, no, you've got to try and get these, you know, run these people off the park. So this whole thing is escalating rapidly. And of course, we've seen what's been happening in Northern Ireland this week, which is, got lots of echoes there.
Do you want to just say what you make of that briefly?
Well, what was rather sad last night, but probably inevitable, was it was the Republican youth of the Springfield Road who went out to fight the police because they don't want to be upstaged by their rivals on the Shankill. And various community workers and Sinn Féin councillors tried to persuade these young lads to go home, but they weren't having any of it. And they were out there, you know, attacking the police from the other side. Underlying all of this, of course, is the tensions around the Good Friday Agreement and the way that Brexit has played out.
This is just tit for tat, surely. And also,
yes,
COVID has been like a pressure cooker for particularly for young people. I mean, they just had enough of it.
Yes, I mean, all of those factors are there. And don't forget, there's plenty of deprivation on both sides of the peace line in West Belfast. And of course, there's still a peace wall there and a gate that can be closed where the confrontations take place. And, of course, we haven't seen anything like this. I mean, at the beginning of the Troubles, these kind of, low-level disturbances escalated very rapidly into full-on fighting, you know, with people being killed in fairly substantial numbers. I think there's an understanding on all sides that they don't really want to go down that road. I mean, the Stormont has had an emergency meeting where virtually everybody there said that they didn't agree with violence to solve problems.
Well, yeah, but
the UDA and the others have also said the GFA that they don't agree with violence and so on.
Well, this is hot air, isn't it? I mean, you know, the fact is that this is going on. It's very easy for them to stand there and say,
no, oh, it's important, Tony. If there was a substantial faction in the Stormont Assembly egging on their own stone throwers and petrol bombers, that would be a bad thing.
Yeah, okay. Yes, yeah, so I'll take your
the
point,
fact
yeah.
that across the board, from loyalist paramilitary representatives to Sinn Féin to everybody is saying, this is stupid, just stop. I think that's got some use. And I'm sure the police are reasonably happy with that. Although, of course, what's really set this off is that the loyalists called for the Chief Constable of Northern Ireland to resign, head of the PSNI, because he allowed the funeral of Bobby Storey, who used to be the Chief Intelligence Officer of the UDA, to go ahead with that. I mean, basically, they negotiated with the police, between the police and the Republican movement, and they basically let them do it. And that was a red rag to a bull to the unionists, saying, well, why are you letting them have their funeral? Is it because they're above the law, et cetera, et cetera?
Well,
it's just
no.
unfortunate that he died at that moment, because it then created this pretended.
Yeah, well, people die, don't they? I'm afraid. And the Duke of Edinburgh's funeral is going to be, I'm sure, much less people going than they were. Anyway, look, on this business of Northern Ireland, surely at the end of the day, someone's going to have to bite the bullet and have some sort of border between the north and south of Ireland, Martin.
No, the border has already been agreed with the EU, and it's going to be in the Irish Sea. And that's exactly what that was exactly the agreement that Boris signed before he stood for election. And he stood for election on the basis of that agreement, which is that there was going to be a border in the Irish Sea. And that's what was always going to happen.
Well, that's a united Ireland, surely. Martin, that's a united Ireland. No wonder the loyalists have had enough.
No, it's not a united Ireland. It just means a customs border in the Irish Sea. There will still be a separate jurisdiction in Northern Ireland. Of course, the only part of the British Isles which will not be having an election on May the 6th is Northern Ireland. And of course, the loyalists are quite pleased about that, because if there was an election, it's quite likely that Sinn Féin would be the largest party. So that then Michelle O'Neill becomes the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland and Arlene Foster becomes the Deputy Prime Minister, because the demographics and also the politics have moved against them. The Alliance Party and the other non-sectarian parties are now about a third of the vote in Northern Ireland, and they all are voted firmly to stay in the EU. They're not going to get that, but they're not going to be leaving the single market anytime soon.
On the subject of the PCC and the local elections here in Bristol coming up in May, the National Union of Journalists, Michelle Stanstreet, our General Secretary, has said it's perfectly possible to make these. She starts by saying the NEJ has warned political parties across the UK against using COVID-19 regulations as a way of restricting reporting of events, campaigns, photo calls and press conferences. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because the two main mayor candidates are just refusing to be interviewed by me. I mean, I may have to go and, well, I almost certainly will have to go and doorstep the guys, you know, even though they're, because they don't want to be asked the questions I'm going to ask them. It's perfectly possible, she goes on to say, to make these events COVID-19 compliant and safe for all involved. Journalists and photographers have a vital role in covering the democratic process of the elections for the Scottish Parliament, Senedd, and local elections in England. The union expects its members to act responsibly and all political parties to be accessible to the full range of the press. The full range of the press. But they're not, Martin. What do you make of the boycott of me by Marvin Rees and Sandy Hall Ruthven?
Well, they're not under any obligation to come on this podcast, Tony. And they're both quite ambitious politicians and they want to be elected. And so you wouldn't be wrong in presuming that they don't want to be asked awkward questions. Their advisors, like Kevin Slocum, who's advising Marvin Rees, will be telling them, you don't have to go on this. And if you don't have to go on it, don't go on it. We're just going to stick to talking to people who are going to give us an easier time. And yeah, there's not a lot you can do about it, Tony.
Well, there is. I can go and find them, and I will. So in the Police and Crime Commissioner elections, we've got Cleo Lake standing as a Green candidate, former Lord Mayor of Bristol, and the founding member of the Countering Colston campaign. Then we've also got Kerry Barker, who was endorsed there by Trevor Mealham, standing for Labour, a barrister who's worked in criminal justice for many years. He came second last time. And also Mark Shelford, also endorsed by Trevor for the Conservatives, an ex-army officer. We interviewed him on this show last week, quite a long interview, which is up on our show page for last week at thisweek.org.uk. He's also an ex-councillor, promised an immediate review into the efficiency of Avon and Somerset Police. And he says that he'll be looking very, very carefully at Lloyds Bank on Castle Park, the business support unit abattoir. Then there's also Heather Shearer for the Lib Dems, the vice chair of the Police and Crime Panel. And finally, John Smith, who Trevor did not endorse. In fact, he was saying people should not vote for him, who is the so-called independent. He believes that he has links to some of the people who've been failing to prosecute Lloyds Bank at Castle Park. The former deputy police and crime commissioner has obviously been working over the last 5 years with Sue Mount Stevens Trevor would put it, cover this up. So just finally, Martin, what about this whole role of police and crime commissioners? It's been imported from the United States, hasn't it?
It has, and I don't approve of it at all. You shouldn't really have to. The police should be independent of political control. There's got to be some kind of political oversight, I agree. But if you're going to have elections to run it, then that's inevitably going to politicise it. So, for example, I mentioned earlier that the loyalist parties in the Assembly in Northern Ireland have called for the resignation of the chief of police, but they're not in a position to enforce that. And similarly, if the Republicans were to call for the resignation of the chief of police, they're not in a position to enforce that. And of course, they've got special circumstances there. But I think in general, in principle, the police shouldn't be directly politically controlled, especially when you've got very, very divided society. They need to be seen to be independent. And that doesn't mean they shouldn't have any oversight at all. But I think police and crime commissioners, don't forget, the turnout in a police and crime commissioner election is often pitiful. People don't even know what they do. They can't really understand what's the point of them. And therefore, you can end up, especially because it's a first past the post election, you can end up for example, in Northern Ireland, you could easily end up with a former IRA member heading the police force. And that would not be acceptable on the loyalist side. And that's why they haven't done it.
So this show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. And also on Sunday lunch at Camberley's Radio QUK.com. I thought it worked rather nicely last week, Martin, having a hymn on Good Friday. So we're going to have another hymn now. I think I might make a habit of this in between our first and second hours, because there's some lovely hymns out there. And please, if any listeners have got particular hymns they like, do let me know and I'll endeavour to play those. I think the idea really here is that we've been stopped for so long joining in and hearing these hymns that it's from in our churches, and there's been an assault really on people's faith during the last year or so, that it's quite nice to hear them again and kind of get us back into the mood. So join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.
The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Amen. Amen. Translated from Latin into English by John Mason Neal, the hymn "Light's Glittering Morn Bedecks the Sky, Heaven Thunders Forth the Victory Cry, Alleluia."
Was Lights Glittering Morn Bedecks the Sky, and that was from St. Matthew's Church, Westminster, last week. And also, you heard their Prudens Futuri in the Name of the One from 1993. Martin, I thought we'd start part two by literally looking at what I think is an amazing little court case in South Africa. This is the strength of the protocols that have been being used during this pandemic across the world, is that doctors are told you're only allowed to prescribe this whatever you think as a doctor, we are telling you this is all very, very top down. So doctors have got together over in South Africa, and over several months, of course, while many people have been dying because they couldn't treat people the way they wanted to, the South African High Court has finally allowed doctors to treat patients with their drug of choice called ivermectin. So this story was the 2nd of April this year. Doctors in South Africa are able to prescribe ivermectin as a treatment against COVID-19. As I understand it, there's also been a court ruling this week. It was an item I heard on the BBC World Service, but I haven't been able to find any reporting of it on the internet. Ivermectin seems to be taboo, and we'll be hearing a little bit about that in a minute. But why is it that doctors are having to go to court to be allowed to use the drug that they believe is going to be best suited to cure their patients?
Well, you know what's going on. We discussed this at the beginning of the first hour. There's big questions over whether vaccines are safe, because obviously they've rushed these vaccines out without testing them in the way that would normally do. The second thing is that there's a vaccine war going on, because the Western pharmaceutical companies, which dominate the world market, are trying to make sure that they remain dominant. And of course, if they were to allow the idea that people should be able to just produce patented drugs, generic drugs, then that would undermine their whole business model going forward. So they're actually quite serious about not allowing that to happen. And I don't have a strong view on ivermectin either way. I don't know enough about it. But you can see that if there are non-vaccines which might help, then that undermines the position of big pharma. I mean, the Pfizer people look to make enormous amounts of money out of this pandemic. But that can only be messed up if other vaccines which aren't them are allowed in, Sputnik, etc. And also if other treatments which aren't vaccines at all are allowed in the game. So they're quite keen to prevent that from happening.
Well, I thought we'd have a listen to the weekly podcast from the doctors that are trying to get this stuff approved. The reason they're doing it is, number one, because it's bypasses the pharmaceutical lobby. As I've said many times on this program, what they've been doing, the FLCCC doctors, frontline critical care, it's FLCCC. What they've been doing is they wrote back in November to Sage saying, look, this, we're getting, around about roughly 75% of the control group are surviving, whereas as against the people dying in the control groups, actually. So you're talking about, in fact, they'll explain it probably much better than I can if we listen to this clip. But they're saying that this stuff is saving people's lives. It stops the development of COVID, particularly at the early stages, in people's bodies. Why can't they use it? And so the obvious answer is, the reason they can't use it is because the policy is being determined by the vaccine lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby. So, without me making mistakes and waffling on too much, let's have a listen to Pierre Corey. And here he is talking. This is Dr. Pierre Corey from Canada. I think he's Canadian. And here is the a little extract from the FLCCC weekly update. He is really saying that he believes that the way that the World Health Organization has obfuscated the use of this product means that they can never be trusted by doctors again, that they've actually completely blown it this time by not endorsing ivermectin as they should have done. So here is that, just as a basic introduction, this ivermectin is very cheap. It was, I think, invented by some Japanese doctor about, 40 years ago or something. It is a anti-parasitic drug. So in other words, it's used for worming and things like that. But it just so happens that it stops the replication of COVID-19 by attaching itself, interposing itself between the virus and the cells, so that the virus can't actually get going in your body. But this doesn't really suit the vaccine agenda. So let's have a listen to one of the other silenced doctors you never hear on the BBC, because it's not what the pharmaceutical industry wants you to hear, Dr. Pierre Corey from the FLCCC.
So I'm just going to give you the lowdown again. I mean, I'm going to call myself an expert at ivermectin and COVID. That's what my life has become. That's all I do. I say the word ivermectin 75,000 times a day. My children, who vary in age from 10 to 16, could give any lecture that I give. That's all they hear is ivermectin in the household. And I'm literally going crazy. But here's the reality is that I know that Andy Hill of Unitaid and WHO, he has the results of over 25 randomized controlled trials, and they come out with a recommendation based on 16. So they're purposely looking at only a subset so they can delay, so that we can wait till August till they can review the others. Anyone think there's a public health emergency going out there? If you do, what would be the definition of emergency? Like all hands on deck? Focus, get through this data and come up with a credible one? No, they're not doing that. But you have to know, and let's be clear here, we're talking about lives, people. The data shows that the reduced risk of death by 75%, that's absolute. That means of every 9 people you treat with ivermectin, 6 of them would be saved that otherwise would have died. You're talking about thousands, if not millions of lives, and the clock is ticking. I mean, it's insupportable, unconscionable, and egregious. From prevention, again, the 7 controlled trials, over 2,400 patients, we know all of those low and middle income countries, all of those places who either can't take a vaccine, don't have the vaccine, don't have access. You could have a countermeasure, an alternative that you could deploy around the world and save millions of lives and prevent tons of morbidity. Yet they're ignoring it. They purposely, maybe they don't have the resources. I guess, you know, all of these organizations, they had the money to do Operation Warp Speed and come up with 8 different vaccines. I don't know if it's 8, but it sounds like it's 8. Every day it's a new pharma company peddling a new vaccine. So millions and hundreds of millions of development into vaccines, and nobody could assign a small little team. I'm available. That's all I do anyway. Oh, actually, that's all I've done for the last 3 months. The problem is no one's paying me to do it. You could look at this data. Apparently, they're choosing not to. Let's be clear. The people are dying. Health systems around the world increasingly stressed, still getting overwhelmed. And early treatment matters. You can change this disease. You can offload the hospitals. You can prevent death and disease. And we know it's working. There's tons of countries around the world who went rogue on the WHO. I think what the WHO did to me, that's my opinion, they made themselves completely irrelevant today. They totally came out and showed that they are not acting in the best interest of humanity and that their guidance should no longer be looked to or followed. I'm sorry, that's just my opinion. And what they really did is they showed what our system is built on, which is that our system is just so vulnerable to influence by competing financial and other misguided influences. And those influences, they lead into these crazy actions that we can't make sense of on the ground. So if you're trying to make sense of it, I gave you my my attempt today. I want to try to get to maybe more positive stuff. Yeah. I mean, here's a funny one about Francis Collins, right? So he said on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago, we know that he's the director of NIH. We know the vaccines are not going to reach everybody across the entire planet. People are going to continue to get sick. We need treatments for those people. Sounds great, Francis. Although he's a proponent, it's not the whole answer. We want something that has broad efficacy against the whole family of coronavirus. Man, I wish we had that. I really wish we could find something like Francis. A big need right now, sorry, is for a drug that you could take by mouth, that you could be offered as soon as you had a positive test, and that would reduce the likelihood that the virus is going to make you really sick. I mean, he's like dreaming. I mean, he's having a fantasy there of this magic pill. Guess what, Francis? You guys, I'm going to make a pitch for donations, but I think today we need a special cause. Donate to the FLCC so we can buy Francis a plane ticket to Mexico City.
Yeah, right.
Because let me tell Francis what happened in Mexico City, December 29th. Their leading healthcare agency decided to adopt what Francis said, which is a test and treat strategy. 250 testing locations all around Mexico City. I don't know how many people live there. I think it's like 18 million. You got a rapid test. If you tested positive, you got ivermectin. What happened right after December 29th? Boom, you see this massive precipitous drop in hospitalizations and fatalities. And again, if I don't mention this every time, I have to. This is Juan Chamilla's work. He does this around the clock. He's constantly watching what's happening in the world around ivermectin. But for the first time, just this past week, the deaths from those that tested positive in Mexico City went under those who tested negative and those who are not tested. Or actually those who are not tested. They're literally decimating the case fatality rate of COVID in Mexico City. So like I said, guys, got to send Francis Collins a plane trip. We'll put him up a hotel. We can schedule him some meetings with some of the health officials in Mexico City, and they might be able to have a little chat.
Pierre Corey there, frontline. I did find out what it's called. Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance. They do a weekly podcast. Fantastic. And various places in South Africa are now allowing doctors to use it. But I just find it shocking, Martin, that doctors are told by the system you're not allowed to use this. We heard Simone Gold several months ago saying that eventually she lost her job for prescribing something called ivermectin, which is about 50 pence a tablet, which was saving four times the number of lives than the prescribed treatment was.
Yeah, and of course, because it's such an old drug, it no doubt has passed all clinical trials that it's not going to cause any harm. So, you know, that's another thing that's problematic for the pharmaceutical companies. If you had a new wonder drug that managed to kill off COVID, then that would be problematic because you wouldn't know if it had side effects and so on. Whereas because this thing's been around for a very long time, it must have presumably got into the, you know, it's a prescribed for parasitical infections and so on, and it must have passed all of the tests to be accepted for that. You know, I'm open to any kind of argument about any of this, but you've got people off. There's a lot of people digging holes and basically mixing all these different things up as if they're all just one thing. There's all sorts of little
makes it very clear there, though, Martin, that he, as a doctor, can no longer trust the WHO.
Well, I mean, what's happened with the World Health Organization was it was originally part of the UN structure and so on. It was supposedly funded by governments and therefore independent of the pharmaceutical industry, etc. But because of all the cutbacks that we've had and all the rest of it, austerity, etc., you've got a situation where it's become a public-private partnership. And the Bill Gates, once the US had withdrawn from the WHO, although, of course, Biden's going to take him back in there, Gates became the biggest funder of the World Health Organization, which is supposedly a public body, which is independent of industry. And that can't be right, can it? It's just bound to it. I mean, what qualifications does Gates have, medical or otherwise, to run the WHO? And the answer is he hasn't got any, but he's got loads of money. Can't be right, can it?
Well, I think, you know, he's just using it to make a little bit more money. And as we heard earlier, you know, you've got this situation where the attempts to turn the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine into something which was going to be open source and not for profit have just been torpedoed. Also this week, the European Court of Human Rights, I have a reasonable amount of faith in this, you know, and it was one of the downsides, we were told, weren't we, of moving out of the European Union. The European Court of Human Rights has ruled obligatory vaccination is necessary. The ruling is the first time that the European Court of Human Rights has weighed in on the issue of compulsory vaccinations. The decision could play a role in efforts to end the coronavirus pandemic. In Strasbourg, it ruled on Thursday that compulsory vaccinations would not contravene human rights law and may be necessary in democratic societies, followed the evaluation of a complaint brought to the court by Czech families regarding compulsory jabs for children. The measures should be regarded as being necessary in a democratic society, the court read. Although the ruling did not deal directly with COVID-19 vaccines, experts believe it has implications for the vaccination drive against the virus. Now, I mean, we did a report, gosh, Martin, must have been about, maybe June, May last year, looking at the amazing coincidence in 2019 of quite a lot of countries bringing in these for the first time ever, these laws mandating vaccinations. Most importantly, I think from memory, it was Germany and Sweden. There were maybe others too. I'm sure there were. But, you know, one can get a little bit suspicious about this, that they knew this sort of thing was coming, and that the idea of mandating vaccines, the main problem here is this breaks the Nuremberg Code, which says after the Second World War and the German experimentation on humans, it said that there should be no coercion, let alone legal mandating of people to take medical treatments, that everything must be done by informed consent. So, you know, you basically have a chat with the doctor says, I think this would be good for you, and you can say yes or no, depending on what you feel. But the idea that you're being told that you've got to have a medical treatment is a very, very new idea, and actually it supersedes this lessons learnt from the Nazi concentration camps, death camps and hospitals in World War II.
Well, I think it's only a legal judgment so far. All they've said is that under certain circumstances, it may be the case that vaccines or any other medical treatment could be mandatory. So, as you say, it doesn't mention COVID-19 at all. Now, I can see that there's all sorts of pressures behind all of this. As we've just been saying, the pharmaceutical industry has got its own interests. They want to force vaccines down people's throats or up their arms for their own reasons. But the legal question of whether you should ever be able to do things against people's will in a medical sense, I think that's an open question. So, for example, quarantine, you could argue people being quarantined is against their human rights. But in actual fact, quarantines and lockdowns, I would argue, until you've got something like ivermectin, are possibly the only thing you have got.
Yeah, but quarantine
shouldn't necessarily be ruled out.
Quarantine is not a medical treatment. It's a confinement of you, you know, for medical reasons. It's not the same thing.
I agree. So in other words, you've got to give the authorities some scope to carry out necessary interventions to prevent the spread of disease. That doesn't mean carte blanche to do anything you like.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't mean going in and, for example, extracting your organs, because, you know, this is a medical procedure. But anyway, you know, the main point here is that the Nuremberg Code is absolutely clear on this, that you don't do any kind of medical treatments to people, specific physical medical treatments to people, injections, etc., without their consent. And certainly without, in fact, that what it says in the Nuremberg Code is about coercion too. So no coercing people to take stuff, and this is just tearing that up. So I'm afraid I'm left wondering about the European Court of Human Rights now as to whether it's really all it's cracked up to be.
Well, I haven't looked at this in detail, Tony. But I think, you know, it's quite right that people should be concerned about it. But I think you've also got to recognise that in an ideal world, which is not the one we live in, or the authorities in any country may have to take steps which will, you know, to some extent infringe people's rights. But you've got to have some balance in that, and look in terms of looking after the population.
Yeah,
you don't, that doesn't mean carte blanche. It just means you've got to trade those two things off.
Yeah, I think what they've taken is a reasonable approach here. They've conned a load of people into taking the vaccine that don't need it, but they're not saying that everyone has to have it. So they're using coercion, which, by the way, is against the Nuremberg Code. But anyway,
yeah, but I mean, a lockdown is coercive, Tony.
But it's not, Martin. I think you're just failing to see that actually having a medical treatment is not the same.
Yes, I can see there's a distinction.
Being told you have to stay in your home, it's not the same thing. Anyway, the court, this article looks at it says these sort of rather snidey headlines like finding ways to combat vaccine skepticism in the UK. Well, I would just say that there is no such thing as vaccine skepticism. There is vaccine intelligence, which means that people have actually looked at the side effects. And I wonder whether the Duke of Edinburgh looked at the side effects of the Pfizer vaccine before he took it back in January. It may be that they simply didn't know what the side effects were going to be, because he's part of a live test of a vaccine, which, again, is totally against the Nuremberg Code. But then they say things like countries across Europe have seen a swell of disinformation regarding the coronavirus pandemic. Well, they've seen a swell of disinformation regarding the coronavirus pandemic from the mass media itself, Martin, too, haven't they?
They have. And I think you know, it's really difficult, but it actually incumbent upon everybody not to take anybody's word for it. And that includes the mass media and the main agenda being pushed, you know, as we see today, wall to wall Prince Philip in the mass media. But it doesn't mean that anybody who's critical has got to be critically assessed as well. Everything has to be critically assessed. Don't take anything for granted.
Absolutely,
whoever says
right. And I will, as I said in the part one, I will put a link up to this fascinating article from the LifeSite News about the London doctor describing unprecedented levels of sickness after COVID injections. I haven't seen or heard this anywhere else, and it is an absolutely riveting read. Quotes copied from the British Medical Journal about one of the doctors in London saying this is going like a Nazi dystopia. And of course, that is the wrong story, but I will make sure that is up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The other big issue this week, surely to do with this whole business, is these vaccine passports. And I do honestly think it's a bit of a damp squib. I don't honestly think they're going to be able to get away with this. They're trying their best, but it's just going nowhere. And let's have a listen now. Rather than, you know, do a sort of in-depth look at that, I thought it would be quite good to hear somebody that I heard, I think it was on Wednesday, on Talk Radio. Someone called Amanda from East Sussex phoned in to the Mike Graham programme to talk about vaccine passports. Well, she calls it China 2.0.
Listen up, people out there, because you need to start contacting your MPs. These vaccine passports are not just going to be a little app on your phone where you go to the pub and you say, hello, Mr. Dorman, yes, I'm vaccinated, please let me in. No. This isn't what these passports are going to be about. In the end, these passports are going to be to introduce the social credit score system that they have in China. That's what they are going to intend these passports for in the future. And I, for one, do not want to live in China, in Europe, China 2.0, based in the United Kingdom. I do not want to live in a country like that. And if that's what they do, I will be packing my bags and leaving. So they need to listen up, government, because we do not want the social credit score system in this country. And Michael Gove is a sinister snake in government, and that is what he is trying to introduce through the back door. Eventually, they will turn into the social credit score system that they have in China, that they forced on the people over there. And I am not going to stand for it, and nobody else out there should stand for it either.
Well said, Amanda. What a great call. What a great speech. You should be put right at the very top of the resistance movement for me, right here in the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Amanda from East Sussex.
Well, that's, Amanda Martin. I mean, you may not agree with what she's saying there about China, but I think everyone would agree with what she said about Michael Gove.
Yeah, I think the way they're going to introduce this is that, as you can see, the politics of it here in this country is that Keir Starmer's making up his mind and he's deciding that he's going to be against it. That's what it looks like. But Boris is, because of whatever pressures he's under, is deciding that maybe he's in favour of it. Don't forget that the whole thing of rushing out the vaccinations and getting a vaccine certificates means we can just go back to boom, boom Britain and build back better and all the rest of it. That's and we can all just forget about this COVID interlude, which they've managed so disastrously. So there's quite a lot of pressure on the right wing of the Tory party to push vaccinations and vaccine passports. But there's so they're in two minds about this. The Labour Party seems to have made up its mind, because it's been talking to focus groups, that they're going to oppose vaccine passports. But the SNP have said that they will consider them if the government puts them forward and talks to them. So it's possible that Boris could get it through with SNP votes, losing some of his Tory votes, and with the Labour Party backing him, opposing him. Interesting. But
it's a bit of juggling going on.
Yeah, a bit of juggling going on. I mean,
what do you make of what Amanda's saying there about the social credit system? I mean, the idea that it's really a way of tracking everybody, you know, everywhere you go.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, Tony, the reality is that we already are being tracked all the time. The only way to avoid that is, like Taliban militants in Afghanistan, is don't have any mobile phones and just do everything by word of mouth. Now, in China itself, the social credit system has come in for an awful lot of criticism because, of course, everybody thinks it's a totalitarian state, we don't want to live like that, et cetera, et cetera. But I read a very interesting article. People piece this week by Larry Romanoff, who's based in Shanghai, and other people talking about how it works. And Godfrey, if you go to the Saker site, there's a very good, very good.
He's gone very pro-China, hasn't he?
He's not gone. He's already been. I mean, what the social credit thing means, for example, that big businessmen who go bust, who try and steal from their workers. This one guy, right, his companies had gone bust. And they basically said, right, well, he's trying to rescue the companies. So they say, right, you can try and rescue the companies. We'll let you do that. But you're not having any first class travel while you're doing that. You will go economy class as you go around to try and beg money to get.
Yeah, but if you don't salute the flag at the right point, you never work again.
Well, indeed. And the point is that the communist system in China, probably people in this country wouldn't like to live in China. I wouldn't like to live in China. But it's worked when it comes to dealing with COVID. They don't have to vaccinate anybody. They can just sit there and wait and see what vaccines look as if they're any good. And if ivermectin works, they can go, right, we'll use that. And don't forget, their economy is actually becoming the growth pole in the world economy as the US economy rolls towards probably the biggest crash ever. And this is all really probably because COVID was created in a lab, as we've discussed week after week, and it was deliberately released in China in order to create exactly the situation that we're in.
Martin, and therefore, you're a genius.
People on all sides, Martin, will be using the same methods to try and win World War III.
Yeah, Martin, you're a bit of a genius because you just brought us perfectly into the next clip, which is from Steve Hilton. This is about 7 minutes long, but here we have another, enormous revelation, almost unreported everywhere else. I ought to say that I've seen that the initial stories from the end of January, beginning of February, where Steve did all of his amazing, brilliant investigations into Dr. Peter Daszak and EcoHealth Alliance and Dr. Fauci being behind the gain of function research at Wuhan for the last four years or so after it was banned by Obama, and all the funding for this US project. I mean, isn't it incredible that in one of the most sensitive bio labs in the whole of China, you've got a whole load of Americans working and Brits, by the way. Peter Daszak is Welsh, I think. He went to university in North Wales anyway. And they're doing all this incredibly sensitive research on the other side of the equivalent of the Iron Curtain. So this week, the revelation was that the guy who was the head of the National Institute for Health in the United States at the beginning, the crucial time of the COVID-19 outbreak, so back in March 2020, has come out as saying he believes that this came from a lab. It's nothing to do with the pangolins, bats, or any other nonsense about wet markets. That's all just a cover story. So let's have a listen to that now.
Breaking news this week from former CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield on the origins of the pandemic.
I am of the point of view that I still think the most likely etiology of this pathogen in Wuhan was from a laboratory, escaped. It's not unusual for respiratory pathogens that are being worked on in a laboratory to infect a laboratory worker.
This is huge. To repeat, the man who was in charge of the Centers for Disease Control at the start of the pandemic believes that it came from the Wuhan lab. Fauci, of course, fought back.
The alternative explanation, which most public health individuals go by, is that this virus was actually circulating in China, likely in Wuhan, for a month or more before they were clinically recognized at the end of December of 2019.
That is an astonishingly weak defense. As we have previously laid out, the pandemic virus was 10 to 20 times more infectious than its closest previously discovered relative. Fauci's suggestion they could have naturally gained that function in a month or so is laughable, but completely in line with his dishonest approach to almost every aspect of the pandemic. We know he commissioned the risky gain-of-function research on bat coronaviruses at the Wuhan lab, And 4 weeks ago, we showed you a statement from Rutgers University's Dr. Richard Ebright, who went on record with us that a 2019 project contracted by Fauci's NIAID, part of the National Institutes of Health, included gain-of-function research of concern. And this week, an interview with Dr. Ebright was published, which is even more of a bombshell than Robert Redfield's. Just listen to what he says about Dr. Fauci and his boss, Francis Collins, head of the NIH. According to Richard Ebright, Fauci and Collins have, quote, systematically thwarted efforts by the White House, the Congress, scientists and science policy specialists to regulate gain-of-function research of concern and even to require risk-benefit review for projects involving gain-of-function research of concern. So let's just be clear what that means. The people in charge of our response to infectious diseases have been the foremost global champions of risky virus research that successive administrations have tried to stop or tightly regulate, precisely because if it leaked from the lab, it could cause a deadly global pandemic. And now we hear, in the words of a world-renowned scientist who's been raising the alarm about all this for years, that Fauci and Collins have, quote, systematically thwarted efforts to regulate what they're doing. There is a ton of other invaluable information and insight in the Ebright interview, including details of the flight range and hibernation patterns of horseshoe bats that cast further doubt on the natural origins theory, and I urge you to read the whole thing. But for now, I want to focus on this shocking and disturbing revelation about Drs. Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins going rogue and potentially causing this pandemic. When will we see a proper investigation and proper accountability? Let's discuss that now with one of the members of Congress who's been pushing for exactly that in the form of a letter to the HHS principal deputy asking for an investigation to NIH's relationship with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. He's back. It's Matt Gaetz. Matt, what do you make of this? The Fauci and Collins systematically thwarted attempts to regulate this risky research.
It was almost a year ago today that I exposed that U.S. taxpayer dollars were going to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And when I called for that funding to be revoked, President Trump called me that night and told me that it would happen. And so at least we can say today that American taxpayers are not funding this risky research. But remember, Steve, on this very program, you chronicled the 2018 cables from the State Department where we knew that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was not up to proper standards when it came to the laboratory researchers and their interactions with these respiratory diseases. So it is entirely possible that you have researchers getting too cozy with China, wanting to maintain those relationships, despite our government having the knowledge that there was a risk of this type of outbreak. Of course, the Wuhan coronavirus that sprung out of Wuhan, China, came out of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And Fauci's argument today, where I guess he like continues the defamation of the pangolin, makes no sense, because even if there was community spread within Wuhan before we thought, that would not absolve the Wuhan Institute of Virology of the lack of safety standards and the high probability that that is precisely where this pandemic was launched onto the world.
Exactly right. And we know that we're going to get absolutely nothing of any use from the WHO investigation. We're supposed to have had it last week. It's been delayed. It's going to be a whitewash whenever it shows up based on what we've seen from them so far. So let's just talk about when the American people might get accountability for this. Because the question is, of course, you're right. You know, the Chinese regime, it was their lab that allowed it to leak out. It looks very much like that was the case. And of course, we know that they engaged in this very aggressive cover-up straight afterwards. That is well documented. But the question is, what were they working on in that lab and why and that leaked? And that could trace back to our own government in the form of Fauci and Collins. Do you think that if the Republicans, if your party takes control of the House in the midterm elections, we might actually finally see a proper investigation into Fauci's role?
Well, we simply cannot wait for that. We have to determine whether or not any researcher, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Collins, or otherwise in the United States, was aware of the lax safety that was going on there and might have been aware of any type of improper utilization of this very sensitive research. We can't wait. We need to immediately utilize the Freedom of Information Act process that is available to any American. So this initial letter that we sent to get answers from the administration is only a first step, but we're going to do follow-up in this Congress. We're not going to promise the people that if they vote for us, we'll take action. We have to take action right now because there could be extensive concern and threat that our country would face going forward if there are these types of arrangements elsewhere.
Fantastic. So are you going to do Freedom of Information requests? Have you already done that? What's the process there?
Yep. Yeah, no, that's absolutely what we're going to do. We're going to get the information with any of the tools that we have available to us. Certainly, it's our hope that we'll get that as a consequence of the letter that we've sent. But Democrats should be joining us with this, Steve. Yeah, Democrats should be on board to get the information, to get it out to the people. Because, I mean, the American people know that something's rotten at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. They know that the World Health Organization and that China are whitewashing the review. And so it's going to be incumbent upon us to get those answers.
Well, they're not going to do anything. They're all in love with Fauci. So, I mean, good luck getting anything sensible out of them. But anyway, Matt Gaetz, I'm glad you're fighting for this. Great to see you. Thank you.
Well, so Rupert Murdoch is no Elliot Carver. And the reason I say that is from Tomorrow Never Dies, the 97 bomb movie. There we've got him actually delivering to a mass media audience around the world on Fox News, or particularly in the US. And then doing the same sort of thing with talk radio, at least making sure that there's some mass media doing it. The BBC aren't touching this, CNN aren't touching it, Sky aren't touching it, Martin. It's only seems to be Rupert Murdoch and us.
Well, Sky is Rupert Murdoch, of course, indirectly.
No, it isn't. No, Sky is not Rupert Murdoch. No, not anymore. He sold it about two or three years ago.
What, do you know the reason why the rest of them aren't touching it? Because it's all being treated as if it was some kind of accidental leak from the laboratory. Now,
MI6 aren't saying that, are they?
Well,
the former head of MI6,
the people from
Richard
the deep state in the West, the
former head of MI6, Richard Dearlove, didn't say that, did he? He said he believed it was a lab leak at Wuhan too.
Yes, I know, but the question is it an accidental lab leak? And of course, there's evidence to show that it may not be. It is already, I mean, people in Italy and Barcelona, they've got stuff from sewage, you know, that was kept, which shows that it was already circulating before what happened in Wuhan. That doesn't mean that there wasn't a leak from Wuhan, and I would suggest possibly a deliberate leak. Don't forget there was also a very strange closure.
Well, hang on, because, you know, let's just make this absolutely clear. Nobody is saying that this was actually made in Wuhan, although, there is some possibility of that. But this funding and the people involved in the research in Wuhan, certainly there were people travelling backwards and forwards. So it may be that this coronavirus, COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2 was made up in a lab either at Porton Down or Fort Detrick or whatever, and then taken over there. But then that is a very important spot on the trail of finding what's happened.
The thing I
admire so much about Murdoch and about Steve Hilton and his work over there is that they are prepared to bite the bullet and say this is not actually China's work. It's work being funded by the West.
Yeah, and of course the suggestion will be by the more loopy people on their side of the fence that Fauci is run by the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party would not, under any circumstances, have released this virus into their population just before the Chinese New Year, which is their equivalent of Christmas. They just wouldn't have done it. Now, it's possible they did it by accident. That's a logical possibility. But I suggest to put it to you that it may also be quite deliberate. And that's why you've got the mainstream trying to shut them up. Because ultimately, where this may lead back to, don't forget that they've got the Bulgarian investigator, whose name I can never pronounce, has shown that they're carrying out exactly this kind of research in Georgia and in Ukraine. And they're basically, there's a spokesperson for the Russian military defense ministry saying exactly that. We suspect that you are carrying out this research, and they're carrying it out on the borders of China and on the borders of Russia. There's basically biological weapons research. And if they manage to get into a situation where they convince the Chinese authorities that they could carry out such research in Wuhan itself, that would be perfect in terms of pinning the whole thing on them when it's not accidentally released, when it's deliberately released. And I think that is where it's ultimately going to end up. And that's it's not accidental at all.
Let's also look at this a little bit closer to home. That is to say, an hour or so's drive away down, maybe 2 hours down to Salisbury and to Porton Down, because we know for a fact that there were hideous experiments done down there on people, particularly on volunteers from the forces, and more importantly, in many ways, live tests of viruses, not necessarily in any way deadly viruses, but to see how quickly they spread from aircraft, dropping the common colds and this sort of thing all around the Dorset coast and places like that. So, I remember chatting to somebody who said, oh, I used to get these terrible colds. Well, you lived down there. Now, he was just being given the coronavirus or other common cold viruses by Porton Down, who were flying planes over his head and spraying them to see how far these diseases would go and where, you know, how many people would go into hospital or into their doctors as a result of it. So, you know, there have been experiments on humans by Porton Down for many years. The other thing I would also remind people about is the Common Cold Research Unit down there in Salisbury, just on the south edge of Salisbury, which was there for many years, which I actually reported on when I was at the BBC. I thought, this is a funny old place. And they took me, they asked me to go and do a report on it, which I did, about 7 or 8 minute report, I think, just before it was demolished, because it had been empty for a few years. This would be about 1992, I think. And this place was used to do this common cold research. Now, a lot of this, of course, links in with this, because if you're thinking, if you've got an evil mind, say you're a Nazi, for example, and you're wanting to spread some sort of deadly disease around, what you do is you find a disease that's natural, that spreads very quickly, and then what you do is you implant something even more deadly as a genetic alteration to it, and you spread that around, and then you can kill millions of people, which is what it seems may well have happened with this COVID-19. And that sort of research is exactly the stuff that they were doing into the vectors for these diseases before they had been genetically engineering them at this Common Cold Research Unit right here on our doorstep in Wiltshire, Martin.
Yeah, and I think that all of this research into biological warfare goes back to World War II and the Japanese and German research into it. And it's fairly common knowledge that at the end of the war, the Japanese have been carrying out all of this research, injecting people with various pathogens. You know, we were talking about the European Court of Human Rights decision earlier, and the deal was done with the Kempeitai, the Japanese secret police, that they would pass over all of the detail of all of the information that they had, the scientific results from all of these experiments on humans, in return for non-prosecution. And therefore, they've been working on this stuff for a very long time, and that they've opened new, and these are the way these facilities are being pushed in Georgia and in Ukraine, as they are researching into potential threats to human beings, and they're basically carrying out defensive research in order to prevent disease. But the suspicion is, and there's been plenty of you will remember that, I can't remember the name of the woman who's done this research, but I'm sure we can put a link up. But she's been saying that these are basically warfare, biological warfare places.
Was this Diliana Katasheva again?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
And, of course, the Russians are basically openly saying, we think that's what you're up to here. And, of course, the Russians will say that they have dismantled all of their similar programs because they can't see that there's any rational use for them. And they may or may not be lying about that, but I tend to believe them, because Craig Murray, when he was British ambassador in Uzbekistan, their version of Porton Down was there. And he said, I saw them dismantle the whole thing. That was that kind of era. And if you remember, after the so-called chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, outside Damascus, It was the Russians who have persuaded Assad to dismantle whatever chemical weapons capacity he had. I think it's the Western powers that have looked for all of these kind of tricksy ways to bring down their opponents. And of course, in Cuba and in North Korea and in China, they know that they are potential victims of biological warfare attack, which is why, of course, the Chinese, when they realized what was going on, had a plan to go to deal with the consequences, because they've always feared that this is exactly the sort of thing that the Americans would try and do to them.
Well, they were quite right to fear that, weren't they? Anyway, finally, on the COVID this week, the bowing out of Vernon Coleman, although another video is now since he's going to be back, apparently. But this is, I suppose, an aspect we don't look at too much, Martin, because it's a lot of this Twitter trolling, etc., is like water off a duck's back to me. I just block people if they're obvious trolls. But Vernon Coleman has been quite hurt by being trolled on internet media, on social media, and particularly with the recent Twitter hate campaign. So this time last week, he posted a goodbye video. He's been doing videos almost every other day or so during the pandemic, giving his take on all this over the last year or so. So let's have a listen now to the sort of bowing out, little bowing out message by Vernon Coleman. But of course, I'm sure he'll be back, but he just doesn't want to be in the situation where he's taking all this online hate from so many people who are making personal attacks against him for doing things like having a go at him for crying over what he on a video about something that he felt very strongly about, that people have been being unnecessarily, well, effectively put through the mill and manslaughtered. So anyway, Vernon Coleman now, as he bows out of his almost every other day videos that he's been doing on, first of all on YouTube, which then started banning all these videos, and then up on brand YouTube.
But now I've had enough abuse. I will carry on writing articles for my two websites, but I'm not making any more videos, and I'm cancelling my trip to London on the 24th. I can just about cope with the abuse from the government trolls. And who knows, maybe the ones attacking me on Twitter are 77th Brigade, I just don't know anymore. But when people who do claim to be on the same side as me say stuff like this, it's just too much. I feel as though I've been knifed in the heart, or more accurately, stabbed in the back. Who the hell do these people think they are? My wife and I have worked all the hours and days available to obtain and share information, often till 4 o'clock in the morning. After her cancer treatment, my wife worked in constant pain because the hospital department was shut. As a result of the campaigning, I've seen my life's work destroyed by often anonymous, sick cowards who rarely do anything but criticise and spread abuse. Right from February and March 2020, I warned these vaccines would become mandatory. That took a great deal of courage, I can tell you. I was virtually alone amongst medical doctors at the time. I've amassed a huge file of relevant scientific papers, and I wanted to carry on, but this really is the final straw. Thank you to Mohammed Butt and to Brand YouTube, who've been marvellous to me. Thank you for watching my videos, those of you who have. If you'd like to visit my websites, you will be very, very welcome. I've never felt so completely despairing and hopeless in my life. I can't cope with any more of this cruel, unthinking abuse for the sake of abuse. Too much is just too much. I've been attacked by the BBC, by Sky, by all sorts of media and much of the internet. After this latest abuse, apparently from within the resistance movement, my wife and I feel rather alone and cornered. I believed, and I still believe, that to win this war, we had to stick together. I must have made 200-odd videos altogether, many of them removed by YouTube and disappeared. But I suspect that these Twitterers have never watched any of them. Thank you to those who did watch them. I hope you found them helpful. And thank you for all your support and encouragement over the year. It meant a lot. Thank you.
So Dr. Vernon Coleman bowing out from his I suppose, a fusillade of incredible videos that he's been putting out, Martin. But, I mean, he talks there. He's saying, oh, people within the resistance movement having a go at me. This is a technique, isn't it? This is an online technique that the troll farms use, and there are troll farms around the world. People pay good money to sit there and basically harass and harangue and attack people. He calls them government trolls, but I'm not so sure. I think they could easily be working for the private sector.
Well, they could be. And, of course, one of the things, you know, we know there are all this, you know, mind manipulators out there, and the social media universe is almost, you know, directly created by intelligence services in order to manipulate people. People should have no delusions about that. And, of course, what the other thing that can happen is you can rouse a mob against somebody, and you can direct them, even though the mob itself doesn't even realize that it's being manipulated. So it's a very difficult world we live in. We've got more information than ever. But the question of whether it's accurate or not and whether people are to be trusted or not is as strong as it's ever been.
Absolutely right.
You've got to be very cautious about anything you say, and you've got to be able to back it up, whoever you are.
You certainly have. Anyway, it's a shame to see Vernon not doing that, because he's done some fantastic. He's been going for God knows decades, hasn't he? Actually, and I would always recommend his book, How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You, which is the first thing that brought him to my attention back in the mid-1990s. But there is another aspect to all of this, Martin, and that is, you know, there is a need to step back from all of this to look at much, much bigger picture, because we tend to focus on the minutiae. And, you know, what specifically, particularly with the doctors, that's what they do. That's what they're brilliantly good at. But there is another side to all of this, because there's enormous changes in behaviour going on as a result of COVID-19. Isn't this also an exercise in what the public will accept? A way to identify businesses and individuals who may, threaten these big lobbies, the arms lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby, the banking lobbies, all these people. Isn't it also a bit of a funny coincidence that you've got tens of millions of people who have been driven into debt by all this, and yet some of the biggest companies in the world have gone, their share prices have gone through the roof. People like Elon Musk, just simply on this basis of the idea of the electric car being mandated again, is saying that, you know, by 2025 we're going to really start moving to it, and totally by 2030 his share prices go through the roof. So the big guys, the handful of what I would call a criminal elite, are doing incredibly well out of this, while there are tens of millions of people, even just in this country, who are being effectively driven out of any opportunity to make a living.
Well, underlying all of this is the collapse of the banking system, the second collapse after 2008, in September 2019, before COVID was actually being openly talked about. It may already have been around, but nobody was talking about it. And what happened in 2008, when Lehman Brothers collapsed, they had to go to the Congress and ask for bailout money, you know, the TARP funds and so on. And there was a big, you know, people were made very well aware that the banking system was demanding loads of taxpayer resources in order to recapitalize it. Now, what happened in 2019 is they'd already set up loads of secret mechanisms to bail out the banking system and the stock markets without having to tell anybody what they were doing. So most people are under the impression that all of this money that's being pumped into the international system to keep the financial services sector afloat, and therefore the economy, as a result of COVID-19, and therefore traces back to the evil Chinese communists with their social credit system, etc. But underlying all of this, if there had been no COVID-19, we'd all be asking the question, why the hell are you bailing the banks out again?
And that, yeah, but what about the? The enormous shift away. I mean, there's also all these distressed assets now.
Yes,
as we know, the massive amounts of money in these hedge funds, and in the property speculators are being able to buy up massive amounts of property for next to nothing, because the people are having to go to auction, for example, saying, well, I'm absolutely desperate to cash in my chips now because I haven't been able to make any money for the last year. So there, this is a massive fleecing by the rich of the poor going on.
It is, and it's been going. It was going on before COVID came along. What COVID has
this
done,
has accelerated it, Martin, massively, and
yes,
it's also accelerated the whole idea of the,
happening.
It's accelerated before. This whole idea of the cashless society too. There's massive changes going on.
Yes, and I would argue that it's not just an accident that all of these things are happening. It all comes back to 9/11 and the role of the deep state in the US. And its tentacles elsewhere. And, you know, people, you know, when we were talking with the Steve Hilton stuff we did earlier, they're talking within a universe where it must be an accidental leak, because nobody would deliberately do that, certainly not to
Well, I don't know about that. I think that's something that they've got to say in order to, you know, get through the regulators over there, basically. They can't immediately go. That's like biting the hand that feeds you.
Well, it is, but ultimately, of course, it leads to a situation where you can't objectively assess what's going on. I'm quite sure the Chinese political and military leadership and the Russian military and political leadership are very well aware, A, that 9/11 was carried out by the US security forces with other allies, and B, that this may not be an accident.
Simply that their editor has told them, look, thus far and no further, and which is better than nothing, isn't it? Which is what
it's
the rest of the media
is doing. But it then leads to people not really understanding that we're actually at war.
I don't agree with you at all. I think this is basically a backhanded compliment, really, and that they are channeling this. They're saying, oh, we don't think it could possibly have leaked, but everybody who's watching and listening knows it could.
Yeah, but I mean, we had that guy at GRU that you had some months ago now saying, well, our analysis of this is a deliberate attempt to trash the Chinese economy. Now, that's what people need to get their heads round. The Chinese Communist Party leadership have got their heads round it. And, of course, they may well sink our aircraft carrier as it arrives in the South China Sea with US aircraft on.
Well, I shouldn't laugh, but you may well be right. In the background to all of this, of course, is the climate emergency or non-emergency, however you want to see it. And we've got the meeting of the COP26 coming up. Greta Thunberg today, bless her, and her PR companies that manage her, is saying she's not going because she wants everyone there to have been vaccinated. Now, I suppose that includes herself, even though she's only in her teens. And you know, any sensible doctor would say, well, you don't need to be vaccinated. She has decided she's now a doctor and she's going to make orders about the COP26 that they've all got to get vaccinated before they go. And she's done another one of her troll-like hissy fits and said, oh, I don't want to, in which case I'm not going. So, of course, the reaction of most sensible people is good. You know. So anyway, so what do you make of the way that this is all interacting with what's going on with the climate? Because certainly the Fourth Industrial Revolution people, the World Economic Forum, etc., think it's all related and it's a great opportunity. Now, the world economy has been forced to slow down to make permanent changes that make sure that it can never take off again.
I think there's definitely an agenda there. You know, whatever you think about climate change, are these people the answer to any problem? The answer is no, they're not. And it's quite obvious that people like Gates are very involved in pushing this kind of super green industrial revolution ideology in the developing world, in places like India and so on. Greta Thunberg, I imagine, is not really old enough to understand all of the things that may be going on. I wonder what her views on 9/11 are. Loads of people were killed there, Greta. What are we going to do about it? I think what I read that she said is that the developing world representatives can't come because of the restrictions on travel, and therefore, and they're, you know, because they haven't got vaccines, whatever, and therefore they shouldn't be, you know, she's not going to go in solidarity with them. And of course, she got into trouble for retweeting stuff in support of the farmers' protests in India, which was then accused of sticking her finger in and so on. So in actual fact, I think she's she is relatively young and she's making her mind up about things as she goes along, but she's not on the same side as Gates on that score at all.
Yeah, but she does seem to have a kind of PR machine behind her. I mean, obviously someone of her ilk is going to have some PR, but you've got to ask the questions. It's a bit like the same question we ask about Mayor Marvin Rees here in Bristol and his spin doctor, Kevin Slocum, like we did of Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell, his spin doctor. Who's really in charge of Greta? Is it Greta herself?
Well, I think I would suggest that clearly she's going to be influenced by older people who are around her. But that doesn't mean that she's entirely wrong or entirely right. As Putin said, well, she's very interesting, but frankly, you know, she can't tell me what to do. I'm a lot older than her, and I used to be a KGB officer, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe people don't like that, but I've just got loads of experience that you haven't got. And it's the sort of experience, of course, which, you know, I mean, Boris Johnson's probably even more clueless than Greta Thunberg, but he's in charge of the British policy, supposedly.
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's all sorts of influential contacts of Greta Thunberg, and quite a lot of stuff which is critical of her has been removed from the internet. I do wonder, though, whether is it ethical, do you think, to use a teenager in this way if she is being used as a PR pawn?
Well, she would argue that she was just somebody, a young person who felt angry about stuff. I'm prepared to take her on face value, but I'm not necessarily going to take all of her opinions as if she knows exactly what she's talking about. I mean, does she know anything about Gladio, for example, about the bombing of Bologna railway station, which happened soon after I slept in it when I was in my 20s? And that's 1980. And the answer is probably not, isn't it? Let's face it.
Is
she going
handler,
to comment on what happened to Toya?
Greta Thunberg's handler is a woman called Luisa Marie Neubauer. She's a member of something called the One Campaign, which is she's paid by them, which is an organisation managed by Bill Gates and Bono, which is funded by George Soros' Open Society Foundation. So, I mean, she's not something that's emerged from nowhere. She's part of a PR machine, which is funded by Gates and Soros.
Yeah, but I think you've got to also recognise you've got to give people the benefit of the doubt, even though you can also point out, look, you're not just a teenager who's come from nowhere, are you? You've got loads of money behind you. It's like, you know, all of this stuff about the Uyghurs and how terrible their conditions are, and it's definitely genocide. That report was produced by people who are funded by the US government. There's no doubt about it. Some of them used to work for the US Defense Department. They're the ones who are writing that independent report, which accuses the Chinese government of genocide. And it doesn't mean that nasty things aren't going on in that region. I've no reason to doubt that it's quite a tense situation. But the idea that these people are independent, Greta Thunberg or the people, the Uyghur National Congress, just isn't the case, is it?
No, no. I mean, yeah, with the Uyghurs, I think there's definitely something happening. A lot of this depends on the spin, doesn't it?
The word genocide is in order to try and prevent the Chinese doing trade deals with people. You've seen the way it's played out in this country, where it's those who don't want to do trade deals with China have basically said, because it's genocide in Xinjiang, we can't do trade deals with China. Now, somebody's got an interest in preventing trade deals with China. That's why they have to use the word genocide. They can't just say human rights abuse or whatever. It's got to be genocide, because that's the word you have to use if you're going to cancel all trade deals.
Let's have a look at some of these international stories anyway. One of the ones that popped up on Fort Russ, rather idiotic to see Facebook now banning everything from Fort Russ. You're not allowed to share anything like that on Facebook because it's too good a website, a bit like some of the others like Mint Press News, etc. Navalny Unlimited, it is, Martin. It's just, of course, Navalny has got this wonderful Bristol connection. Alexei Navalny, the so-called Russian opposition leader, who's an unashamed racist, he is very much closely associated with our wonderful Marvin, the marvellous Labour mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees, who did this amazing endorsement of Alexei Navalny, you know, a character reference for him on Sky TV, just a few days before Amnesty International dropped Navalny from their prisoners of conscience because he was such an unashamed an unrepentant, unapologetic racist. And the treatment, apparently, according to political diagnosis, that's what's going on, according to Brian Fitzgerald on Fort Russ. He says, when a healthy lifestyle hurts. On December the 17th, 2020, the mayor of Kharkov, Gennady Kerner, died while in the care of Berlin's Charité Clinic, one of the oldest in Germany. And the the article goes through, Martin. It's quite fascinating. The number of cases that have gone to this Berlin Charité Clinic, it seems that quite a lot of the people who are friendly to the Western intelligence services are miraculously saved there. But anybody that isn't seems to go in there for this miraculous treatment and die.
Well, I haven't read the report or the article that you're referring to, but obviously, I mean, the Russian position on this has been clear from the get-go, which is that when they allowed Navalny to leave Omsk on the plane after he'd been, they basically revived him, checked him to see if he'd been poisoned, decided he hadn't. They were put under pressure that he should be allowed to go to Germany. So he flew to Germany, paid for, again, by people who've got a vested interest in paying for him to go. And then it was a military lab that said that they found Novichok, which is absolutely extraordinary, on his water bottle, which had been taken independently from the hotel that he'd stayed in to Germany, and then given to the authorities in Germany. But they've not shown, and the Russian authorities have said, well, if you've got evidence of Novichok on the bottle, send it to us. But they haven't done that. All of which suggests that there is no such, this is all a come on. In any case, as we know from the Salisbury case, Novichok, I was reading this week that they're telling people not to do litter picks in Salisbury because there still might be a problem with Novichok. Which is, yeah. Novichok is designed to kill battalions and divisions of military personnel. You know, you drop Novichok on a tank division, and it's supposed to kill everybody in that tank division. It's not the sort of thing you use to poison individual people. Never was. And this,
yeah, and you can't certainly get a load of the stuff, whatever was in that so-called perfume bottle, all over your hands.
Indeed.
Survive it.
In other words, the bad faith of the Western media spin, you know,
treachery.
The mighty Wurlitzer, as Fred Wisner calls it, is just, I mean, it's so obvious, for example, that Navalny has got very, very limited sympathy inside Russia itself.
Can I just get back to the Charité Clinic, because it's apparently the best clinic in Germany with an impressive record of treating serious conditions, a hospital that saved the lives of Viktor Yushchenko, Yulia Tymoshenko, Alexei Navalny.
These are all people who are supposedly poisoned by the evil Russians, and they go to this facility to be rescued. I mean,
or to be bumped off. Notably, he says.
Well, it depends. If you cross them, and you don't come out.
It's at the very same Charité hospital where Irina Becker, nicknamed Sister Death, worked as a nurse. She was sentenced to life imprisonment for 2007 for the murder of 5 patients, laying bare the failure of German medicine. By the way, he says, just a few months from now, this woman is about to walk free for good behaviour. During her work at the German clinic, she hounded and tortured the patients she didn't like, killing them by administering lethal doses of drugs. At some point, she forgot an empty vial of a dangerous drug, which ultimately led to her arrest. The exact number of her victims is still unclear, but it left many questions about the organisation and control over medical personnel at this supposedly best German clinic. So it's fascinating, isn't it? The politics of medicine, I think, has really been brought out by the pandemic, but particularly by this whole incident with Navalny.
Yes. I mean, I haven't read the article, so I won't comment until I've had a look at it. But I mean, I think the fact that they sent this so-called, and of course the other thing is ultimately, and Bellingcat were in on all of this, was that it wasn't actually on the bottle at all. So the story keeps changing. So it was actually on the water bottle. That's where it came from. First of all, it was in his cup of tea. Then it was on the water bottle. And now, of course, the final version of the story, it was on his underpants. And of course, we know that because Bellingcat has been told by the Western intelligence services that this was actually on his underpants. Now, all of this plays quite well. I mean, the reason why they do these kind of scams, because it plays quite well in Western public opinion. I'm quite sure that the average Labour Party member, even in Bristol, who's probably going to vote for Marvin, whatever reservations they may have, they probably think that if Navalny was a friend of Marvin's, then he's probably all right, etc., etc. And of course, what do they know about Russian politics? The answer is zero. But of course, within Russia itself, this kind of propaganda massively misfires. People would be wrong to presume that in China and Russia that they are not exposed to Western propaganda. Both governments have quite wisely opened their airwaves to Western propaganda so that they can see what's being said about them by the West. And in both countries, most educated people can speak English, so they can hear what's being said about
it. It doesn't work the other way around. It doesn't work the other way around. We've got the Iranian channel banned here, which I'm on for 3 times a week. And, you're not even allowed to get on a satellite with Press TV.
Well, you're not allowed to go on YouTube now, I understand. They've taken them off YouTube.
Well, what they do is they're an amazing lot. They just keep going. You know, they're right, okay, they've got YouTube channel.
In this day and age, you can be banned, but you just carry on anyway. But, of course, it does have an impact. Because it means that people have to search you out rather than just find you.
Of all sorts of fascinating stuff on there, which good old Google and the Bilderberg chums have just deleted from the internet. In fact, it's worth mentioning again that Steve Hilton and his reports, which were out there on various news services from the end of January, beginning of February, about the American funding of gain-of-function research at the Wuhan lab, which could have most likely led to this COVID-19 outbreak, has all disappeared off of that. You can see it on the search engines, or at least you could last week, and you click on the link and it says, oh, page not found. So this is what's going on. It's this Orwellian destruction of the truth, the idea of management of history within sort of 2 or 3 weeks of it happening. It's gone. But anyway, we're going to go back even further than that now and have a look at 9/11 again, particularly since we briefly touched on it last week, which is this up and coming petition attempt to reopen the inquest into the death of Matt Campbell's brother, who he lost in the 9/11 attacks here in the UK, along with some other families. Matt's the spokesperson for. But before we hear from Matt, let's have a look at a couple of recent stories to do with 9/11 itself. This is, of course, we think we knew what happened because we watched it at the time. Of course, we don't, because the truth has been trickling out ever since. This is one recently, Martin. Mossad link found to one of key 9/11 hijackers. A new Israeli connection to the tragic events of September 11th, 2001 has been unveiled. Buried in a New York Times story was the eye-opening revelation that a Lebanese Muslim Arab who's been taken into custody in Lebanon has now had evidence of him being a spy for 25 years for the Israeli intelligence service, the Mossad. He just happens to be first cousin of one of the Muslims alleged to have been one of the 9/11 hijackers. Although Ali al-Jarrah was publicly an outspoken proponent of the Palestinian cause, it now turns out he was actually working as a paid asset of the Israeli Secret Service for over 20 years, betraying his own nation and conducting spying operations against Palestinian groups and the pro-Palestinian party in Lebanon, Hezbollah. His cousin is Ziad al-Jarrah, and he was one of the UA-93 alleged hijackers, Martin.
Well, I find that extraordinary. I mean, because all of the hijackers, whatever, the official story is that they were all Sunni Muslims. And so I imagine that this guy is probably a Shia and an infiltrator into Lebanese. That's interesting, but it doesn't necessarily lead us any further into the maze, does it?
Well, what it is indicating that the Mossad fingerprints may be on it. But much closer, showing that the intelligence services were involved. I mean, we had the brilliant presentation, two-hour presentation, a clip from it last week by Webster Tarpley about 9/11, the key to stopping World War III. where he explains how intelligence agencies do these things. Of course, they're totally unaccountable. The MPs haven't got a clue what they're doing. The journalists are running around at sixes and sevens. They are absolutely clueless as well. And so these intelligence agencies just do whatever they want and then bamboozle their way through the democratic process, whether that be journalism or whether it be parliamentary scrutiny or whatever. But anyway, this is just from the other day, this one, evidence showing top Al-Qaeda operative who aided 9/11 hijackers was working for the CIA. This is on the UN's review. The author of the article is Eric Stryker. For decades, state officials in nations like Iran and Syria have held that Al-Qaeda, ISIS and other Salafist terror groups are agents of chaos, trained and armed by the United States and Israel. Now, finally, there's a smoking gun, he says. 2 weeks ago, Major General Abdul-Qa'a al-Shami, the deputy security chief of the Houthi rebel government in Yemen, unearthed a recording of a 2001 conversation between ex-CIA director George Tenet and former Yemeni president Ali Abdullah Saleh. Yemeni president, regarding the US-born Al-Qaeda operative Anwar al-Awlaki. President Saleh, who the Houthis shot in 2017 for treason, had al-Awlaki, known as the Bin Laden of the internet, detained over his role in directing the 2000 bombing of the US Navy vessel the USS Cole, where 17 sailors died and 37 were injured. Following the attack, the FBI travelled to Sana'a, ostensibly to investigate the incident. In an exchange that could politically revolution our understanding of the war on terror, Tenet instructs the Yemeni leader to release him. The CIA calls him my person. Saleh says, do you have his name? Tenet says, I don't want to use his name on the phone. They know his name. Saleh says, George, the FBI people have arrived in Sana'a. They're now in Yemen. Why don't you recommend them to come and meet me tomorrow along with the US ambassador and prevent this case during my discussion with them and we can discuss it? Tenet says, President, I'm happy to do that, but let me say something very important. This is my person. This is my problem, my issue. I'm calling you because it's very serious for me personally. This man must be released. So there you got it. And maybe, perhaps that's why Saleh was assassinated, Martin, or executed, because he knew too much.
Well, he was killed by the Houthis because they basically, you know, they'd fallen out. But I think this is all because the Houthis managed to get hold of the tape. And of course, underlying all of this is the obvious point to make that Al-Qaeda was set up by the CIA and the Saudis to fight in Afghanistan in the first place. That's all, that nobody disputes that. And the claim is that somehow, having been given all this training and direction, weaponry, all sorts of things, they suddenly went rogue and decided to bite the hand that fed them. What can you do? But nevertheless, even in recent weeks and months in Syria, we've got exactly the same Al-Qaeda-linked groups being directed, armed and trained by British military intelligence. We've got the evidence coming out all the time. So people need to wake up. The Iranians are very well aware of all of this. So are the Russians and the Chinese. All of the Salafist terrorism that's being orchestrated around the world, Charlie Hebdo attack, everything, it's all being done by Western intelligence services working with the Israelis and the Saudis.
So let's have a listen now to Matt Campbell and his petition to reopen his brother's 9/11 inquest now. A longer version of this will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But here's the crux of what Matt Campbell's hoping to achieve here with this.
I've probably since 2014 had this idea that, you know, reopening the inquest with the tons of evidence that's out there showing, you know, that the towers were brought down by explosives and incendiaries. I started, I guess, in earnest 2016, a little bit of fundraising just to see, test the waters with a barrister that I'd chosen. And really, I'd say in the last 12 months is where it's all accelerated. So I was in contact with Ted Walters from Architect Engineers for 9/11 Truth for a fair few years. And last year we just sort of discussed the possibility of A&E getting involved and helping with the necessary fundraising of, you know, through their supporters to raise the necessary funds to get a barrister to work on an application that, you know, we could obviously submit. So we've been busy pretty much since August last year. And you know, although it's slower than I thought it would be, it just is the nature of you know, getting together all the statements from experts, statements from eyewitnesses, first responders, statements from other victim family members, and just everything that's involved. It just, you know, it just takes longer than you think. But I think we're in a good position. I'd be still be hopeful that we could submit at the end of this month, but I wouldn't be surprised if it sort of bleeds into May. But it is, you know, it's imminent. We're nearly there. We're just trying to, you know, finalise everything and put together the best application we can, because we've only got one shot at this, Tony. You know, the Attorney General, based on our evidence that we submit, and, you know, showing that there's a lack of inquiry in certain areas, on the basis of that, it's Michael Ellis, who's the acting Attorney General, and his team have to make a judgment as to whether they will grant their authority or not to make an application to the High Court for them to quash the original inquest and to order a coroner's court to reopen a fresh inquest. And so, yeah, I mean, that's where we're at. So the key thing is to get the authority granted by the Attorney General.
I mean, this business of explosives, you know, surely if you see a building and a plane crashes into it, you've got raging fires, it then collapses, surely you don't need explosives. I mean, for most people looking at the September 11th attacks now, all these years later, I mean, isn't it sort of intuitive that the planes crashing into the buildings, then raging fires, you know, they, of course, surely the building's going to collapse. And I mean, I don't wish to be rude, but I mean, that's what most people believe, surely, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's the official narrative that was put out fairly early on, and then backed up with, you know, reports by the various authorities in the US. I mean, there's a couple of things there. You know, prior to that day, you know, no steel-framed high-rise building had ever collapsed through fire, notwithstanding, okay, obviously there were impacts into the two towers, but you also have the Building 7, which was a huge building in terms of relative to towers that we have in the UK, 47 stories. That wasn't hit by a plane. It suffered fires and some damage to the, I think it was the south side of the building. But that collapsed about 7-8 hours later. And part of that collapse was at free fall acceleration for about 2.25 seconds. Which, you know, basically says there was no resistance, no structural support whatsoever underneath that building. So, you know, there's a couple of things that I guess are unusual. So although an official narrative has been applied to that, saying that it was the obviously the fires from the subsequent planing packs that brought down the towers, the interesting thing to note is, I mean, from just purely, you know, an investigation, is NIST, who were tasked, that's the American organisation that were tasked to investigate the collapse of the towers, never actually investigated or went through the model of how the towers would collapse. They'd only investigated up to what they called collapse initiation. The actual mechanism has never been formally investigated or, you know, reported on. But, you know, that aside, you've got evidence of thermitic reactions. You've got, you know, an incendiary, an unexploded incendiary being found in the dust. There's a peer-reviewed published paper on that. You've got oddities of, you know, the way the South Tower fell, which, okay, doesn't directly involve my brother's death, but, you know, it toppled over and yet it still managed to sort of pile drive the rest of the building down. But then you've also got the peculiar constant two-thirds of gravity acceleration of the North Tower, you know, without any slowing of the descent of the building at all for the first sort of four seconds. You've got, like I said, numerous eyewitnesses who gave their statements. The authorities had these statements, but they were kind of dismissed out of hand. So you've got, I think, a third of all first responders, and you're talking about 150, 160 people who are, you know, firefighters, paramedics, you know, all reporting explosives and belts of what they call it, you know, sounded like a belt of explosions going off. You've got oddities with seismic data that's showing, you know, explosives just going off prior to the plane impact in both buildings. And it kind of goes on. There's a lot of stuff out there, but my point is, you know, it comes back to none of this was considered at all by the coroner where my brother had his joint inquest. I'm not blaming the coroner. She could only deal with what was presented to her at the time. You know, for me, if I was going to blame anyone, it would be the Met and the counterterrorism officers that were involved in preparing the report that she obviously had to rely on when she weighed up the what was presented in front of her and gave the narrative that she did.
Not them again. The Met and the counter-terror people, the same people responsible for the cover-up of the 7/7 attacks. Martin, this is starting to look, isn't it, as if he stands a reasonable chance of this. But, one of the things that he says in the longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, is that the reason that his brother was in the World Trade Center was actually to help him do a deal. I mean, he was based elsewhere, but his brother was in there to do a little favour for him. And so obviously he feels responsible, Matt. But at the end of the day, why are we still talking about September 11th attacks now, 20 years afterwards?
Well, because they obviously were an inflection point in the world crisis which developed subsequently. And, of course, Matt was interviewed for the Daily Mail the other week, so the mainstream media have picked up on what he's saying, if they could call the Daily Mail mainstream. Paper of record, ha-ha. And, of course, what he didn't mention there is the University of Fairbanks, Alaska, peer-reviewed study which showed that the buildings could not have collapsed as a result of fire damage, which is pretty much, that's pretty clear anyway. But over the years, it takes years to get peer-reviewed stuff through universities. They managed to do it, and they've got one. They've got a report that says, look, we've looked into this. It's peer-reviewed. They couldn't possibly have collapsed in the way you say. And the same goes for Nils Harriet and Steve Jones's chemistry analysis of nanothermite in the dust from the tragedy.
Well, one of the bits
which again had to be peer reviewed through all of the chemistry journals and so on. Well, that is new evidence that wasn't available to the coroner on the day.
One of the bits of news I got, very sad bits of news, was about the death of Scott Forbes. Now, Scott, if anyone knows, was working in the World Trade Center the weekend before the attacks in New York, and he had been involved in a power down, which was taking all the systems for his company, Fiduciary Trust, that he worked for, down. He then went, once everything had been safely switched off, he then went back home, and he had on Tuesday a day off in lieu. And he watched from his flat in New York, he watched the attacks take place, including the plane flying into the second plane flying into the second tower. He actually watched it as it came in to New York. So Scott was a fascinating eyewitness, very sad to hear of his passing, but he was absolutely adamant that the bombs were put into the building at the weekend that he was there, at least that's what he believed. And he put in freedom of information requests to the Port Authority, demanding to know what had happened. Well, after much, much prevaricating, they came back to him with a rather mealy-mouthed reply, is we don't know anything about it because all of our documents have been destroyed. We're very sorry, of course, which he was rather angry about. But Scott was convinced that there was something dodgy going on over the weekend when he was working in there. And so I'll put the full article with Scott Forbes up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But here's a little extract from it. I interviewed him in a park next to the Embankment Underground Station back on the 18th of July, 2007.
Going into the towers from the ground floor, employees had security badges in order to pass through gates to reach the elevators. Once you were in the elevator, it was just push button. To gain access into our offices, we then had a separate security badge to gain access into our offices. So all of that was in operation going in on the Saturday to do the power down. From the ground floor, it was clear that there was activity, there were people around beyond the normal. the ground floor elevator took us to the lobby at 78. And on the 78th floor lobby, again, there was unusual activity. There were people around and cabling and boxes, toolboxes. Then from there, I took the elevator up to the 97th floor, and I didn't see any activity on our floor, frankly. I remember it on the lobby areas.
Okay, so can you just describe these people? What did they look like? I mean, did they have any sort of, like, big company logo or anything like that on their jackets as they're working?
I can't remember specific details about individuals. You know, I can't describe you individual guys. And I can't remember any logos at all. I've been asked whether I saw any vehicles outside. I can't remember seeing any vehicles. I just remember guys in, like, blue and grey overalls, like workmen. That's all I can describe.
And roughly how many? Have you any idea? I mean, you probably have only seen a few at the bottom and in the lobbies, but, you know, roughly how many people did you see?
I would have said three or four down in the ground floor lobby, three or four on the 78th floor lobby as well.
So there we've got an eyewitness of people who weren't supposed to be there at the weekend, Martin, just before the attacks.
Yeah, and of course we've got William Rodriguez, who is the janitor in the World Trade Center, who's quite clear that the building was bombed, and people can look him up by going on the internet or whatever. I think the evidence is piling up about 9/11 and the significance of it. It's always been significant because it's the most important of the psychological warfare operations that have been carried out by NATO intelligence services. They did lots of stuff like Bologna before that, Piazza Fontana in 1969, but this is the cherry on the cake. And, of course, with the 20th anniversary coming up, the powers that be are going to be banging the drum about how terrible it was and why we've all got to keep on our guard against the evil al-Qaeda militants that we are arming and training in Syria. But, of course, the 20th anniversary, they haven't achieved the goals that they set themselves. Wesley Clark, the former US general, was saying that various countries were going to be taken down. Iraq, Libya, no,
what he said, Martin, he said seven countries in 5 years, and that, of course, it never happened.
Well, it did happen. Libya and Iraq were invaded, and Afghanistan, Libya and Iraq were all invaded. And, of course, there's been all sorts of other things in West Africa and so on. But the Syrian Arab army and their allies have, you know, it's like a massive, long, drawn-out Stalingrad have prevented the next step, which was to take down the Iranians. Mm. The Iranians were the ultimate goal. And, of course, after that, it was going to be the Chinese and the Russians. So this is all about...
So the Holy Roman Empire was turned back on the road to Damascus.
Well, you could say that, but it's not that would be a poetic, flourish.
Well, I'm allowed that from time to time, aren't I?
Well, of course, I mean... People can the general delineament of what's going on in our lifetimes is pretty clear now. I'm 61 years old, and we've been, you know, been campaigning around these issues going back before 9/11, because I was somebody that was always very interested in Gladio, because I went to Italy as a teenager in the 1980s.
Can you just say something about that? Because if you were actually there at the time, it was a very convincing. The idea was that in order to be a revolutionary, you had to join the Red Brigades, and this was. But there was CIA had actually infiltrated it, haven't they? Or even
maybe started it. That's a vast oversimplification. I mean, there was that. What was happening was that the Italian Communist Party, which was a very well established party, it was like the Labour Party here, but they found it very difficult to operate because ultimately the Americans had decided that they didn't want. That, you know, the Italian Communist Party by the 70s had become very reformist. It wasn't in any way Stalinist orientation. So, for example, in 1968, when the Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia, the Italian Communist Party condemned the invasion of Czechoslovakia. So they weren't, by any stretch of the imagination, pro-Soviet by that stage.
They weren't tankies.
They weren't tankies, quite literally, yeah. But they weren't going to be allowed to come to power in Italy because it would have created a dynamic by which communists can win elections and do reasonable things. They've been running places like Bologna for decades by that stage, and Bologna was a clean, well-run, probably one of the most high-quality life cities in the country. Very limited crime, you know, quite liberal in every respect. And, you know, they demonstrated their capability for running a modern society, including, for example, a very robust small business sector, which many communist people worked in. But they couldn't be allowed to come to power because it would just set a bad example. It's the same as the Nicaraguans winning their revolution in the 1970s, only to find that they're not going to be allowed to have a revolution. I mean, they're not really any kind of threat to the United States, but it's treated as if they are going to, you know, bring the roof down. And you've got to think back to the era. I mean, when the mainstream, if they ever do bother to look into this, look into it, they say, well, you've got to understand that they were facing the totalitarian monstrosity of the Soviet Union, and therefore they these kind of tactics that they were using of you know, fake bomb attacks and so on. And in fact, you find some politicians on the right in Italy who openly say, yes, that's what we were doing, and we're proud of it. I mean, it's all there in Frankovich's film.
They're very much real bomb attacks, aren't they? But blamed on
real people die, yeah.
Even though they're being carried out by the NATO intelligence services. Anyway, Martin, we mentioned briefly last week about the foundation of the Operation Gladio campaign of the NATO intelligence services based in Brussels on the idea of the SS werewolf units, which were the brainchild of Heinrich Himmler. At the end of the war, the idea was, as the Allies advanced, these guys were going to have, you know, maybe Allied uniforms or civilian uniforms pop up behind enemy lines and cause all sorts of mayhem and sabotage. So I thought we'd have a listen to a little clip of one of the little documentaries there is on YouTube about the werewolves, because they're a fascinating bunch. And isn't it interesting that this is basically grafted directly into NATO, as were some of the senior generals. So let's have a listen. You know, I'm talking about the Nazi generals into NATO. And not only that, they brought the SS werewolves with them. So let's have a listen to this clip now, explaining a bit about the werewolf campaign by the Nazis at the end of the Second World War, and something called Werewolf Radio, which was blasting out from southern Germany, the mountains down near Switzerland and Austrian and border, scaring the Allies to death.
The idea of creating some kind of behind-the-lines German resistance organization originated with Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler. The original concept was something akin to Otto Skorzeny's commandos, highly trained and well-armed, uniform formations, rather than Nazi partisans. Himmler chose SS Obergruppenführer Hans Adolf Putzmann to oversee the organization in autumn 1944, after the German defeat in Normandy had apparently shown him the writing on the wall for Nazi Germany. Interestingly, the Allies were thinking along the same lines as Himmler, and US analysts reported in January 1945 that the Germans were preparing stay-behind forces in preparation for the Allied invasion of Germany. The British and Americans were fairly concerned about a protracted guerrilla campaign behind their lines. Further proof of German intentions seemed to be confirmed when Propaganda Minister Dr. Goebbels made a fiery speech to the German people on the 23rd of March 1945. This speech became known as the Werwolf Speech, when Goebbels exhorted every German to fight to the death against the invader. The Propaganda Ministry organized Radio Werwolf, which began broadcasting on the 1st of April 1945. The show was opened with the sound of a wolf howling and exhorted fighting to the death. These broadcasts unsettled Allied forces further, making troops mistrustful of German civilians. General Putzmann apparently took some measures to turn Himmler's and Goebbels' idea into a reality. A Werwolf central training center was established at a castle near Erkelenz, training batches of 200 older Hitler youths and some SS volunteers in each intake. Each regional Gauleiter was ordered to draw up lists of potential recruits for the Werwolves, who were then to be trained at locations in the Rhineland or around Berlin. The entire force numbered, apparently, about 5,000, but they were short of weapons, equipment, and training. Some caches of weapons and explosives were created, but most were found by the Soviets or the Allies, while the organization broke down into unrelated or coordinated cells or even individuals who committed some acts of sabotage or assassination against the Allies. The Americans arrested several cells that claimed to be part of Wehrwolf, groups of servicemen hiding out in remote places, some with U.S. uniforms and kit. Some operations have been claimed as Wehrwolf activities. In March 1945, Himmler ordered the assassination of the American-appointed mayor of Aachen, Franz Oppenhoff, who was duly dispatched by an SS hit squad on the 25th of March. Most assassinations and attacks were in reality conducted by regular German troops or SS in battle conditions. But Goebbels' Wehrwolf radio was happy to claim responsibility in order to sow alarm and confusion in the Allied ranks.
So there's a little report on the werewolves, Martin. It does sound very, very similar. These stay-behind forces, they pop up and they do something which can't necessarily be blamed on them, but it's certainly incredibly disruptive. Can you just tell us what you think the Gladio units gained from, you know, this is their sort of where they were originally spawned from this Nazi operation?
Well, I think what you will have found is that on the Allied side, some people will have regarded these people as a threat and, you know, they've said, well, they're going to fight back. We're going to have to be prepared to deal with this. But as you know from your research into what happened with Bormann and with others, a modus vivendi was found with the occupying forces, particularly the Americans and the British, of course, indirectly. So in Bulgaria, the end of the war, Frank Thompson, who was the brother of E.P. Thompson, the famous anti-nuclear campaigner, he was parachuted into Bulgaria to work with the Bulgarian resistance, who were communist resistance. He was a communist. But he was grassed up almost immediately to the Gestapo and basically tortured to death because deals were being done at that stage between the Germans and the OSS and MI6.
Oh, you mean the OSS dubbed him in?
Yes.
Right.
That's what his brother believed. E.P. Thompson fought in the he was a tank commander, but his brother was a special operations person because he had all the languages. He was a great linguist. What was happening at that stage is that the Germans obviously are not quite sure how they're going to be treated. And the Western powers are not quite sure what they're dealing with. But, of course, when you've got people like Morton, who was Churchill's personal secretary, directly talking to people like Bormann via Ian Fleming and Crichton Davis, and of course, there have been lots of linkages because intelligence works like that anyway. You know, if you watch Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, you'll realise that everybody, you know, you can't be sure whose side anybody's on. But I think as the Cold War developed, it became clear that they wanted to create a stay-behind network. That's how it was originally, and we know about this from parliamentary investigations in Switzerland, Italy and Belgium, that these networks were set up and they used the previously existing networks because don't forget these people are trained. They've got lots of access to weaponry, which were then provided for them. And of course, they were supposedly initially it was the idea that if there was a Soviet invasion, they would do the same sort of thing. But of course, there never was going to be a Soviet invasion, and there wasn't. And then, of course, they started intervening in West European politics in a very underhand way in order to steer things in the direction that the new masters...
Yeah, I think I remember reading that the CIA's budget for Italy was the biggest that it had ever been. There was a massive amount of money spent in Italy fixing elections by the CIA.
Yeah, the 1948 election, nowadays they do it through the National Endowment for Democracy and say we're funding all of these opposite people. And the same thing happened in Chile. I mean, they used to do this under the table, but of course they're not just funding politicians that they like, they're also actively sabotaging the people they don't like through dirty tricks of one kind and another.
Yeah, but all this rivalry with the Russians that was going on at that point, you know, with the Allies doing these little dirty deals with the Nazis,
in order to get the Cold War fired up straight away after the war, and they're doing the deals during the war. We're now in the situation, aren't we, where the relationship between the United States and Russia is entirely broken down. I see this week the Russian's foreign ministry has revealed it has no plans to restore diplomatic representation in Washington until it sees evidence that the US is interested in having a constructive relation between the two countries. But what the Russians are saying is that there are no bilateral relations. So what's the point of us having an ambassador there? And he was withdrawn, Anatoly Antonov, the day after we had that ridiculous ABC interview where the interviewer, what was his name, George Stephanopoulos or something, is putting words into Biden's mouth. I mean, Biden is just nodding and saying yes. And as a result, there's no ambassador in Russia anymore. This is totally unprecedented, Martin. And also, it's farcical in a way, because actually it's the press, it's ABC, which has caused this. It's nothing to do with Biden, who's just there as a nodding dog. Sleepy Joe doesn't have anything to say and doesn't have anything to think.
Well, it's not just the press. The press is working closely with the deep state and all
Operation
the rest.
Operation Mockingbird.
Yeah. I think what's very dangerous is, if you've seen in some of the press in the West, they've been going on about how the Russians are, preparing to invade Ukraine. And, of course, what the Russians are doing is that the Rada in Ukraine has passed a law calling for war with Russia. Basically, they basically declared war on Russia. We are going to claim back the eastern provinces and Crimea, and they're moving loads of weaponry up to the front line. It's been suggested, following this very closely, it's been suggested that British military will actually lead the charge. You know, they will go there as advisors, but they'll actually do a lot of the dirty work because the Ukrainian army is basically dysfunctional. And they can't win a fight like this, but by starting a fight, then pointing the finger at the Russians saying, that look at these terrible Russians, they can then cancel the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and, basically create a situation where there is no positive dialogue between Russia and the and,
I mean,
and
this is
Europe.
Massive. Martin, this is massive, isn't it? This never happened
since
the Russian Revolution, that we've had no Russian ambassador or Soviet ambassador in Washington. And yet it's hardly reported at all. This is an enormous split between East and West. And it surely means that, if there's no bilateral relations, how far are we from some sort of serious conflict?
Well, in the Donbass itself, there's quite a few, there's ongoing shelling and so on. A lot of the Ukrainian army have ended up being blown up on their own mines because there's minefields between the two sides. And they've been trying to work out where, they need to clear their own minefields if they're going, as happened at El Alamein, for example. You've got to clear your own minefields if you're going through to attack the other side. And that, these ill-trained, drunken soldiers have been blowing themselves up. But they've been given a lot of training in things like using drones. So a drone was used last week over Donbass to kill a six-year-old child. Six-year-old boy was killed by this drone. Now, of course, everybody in Russia is getting this on their TV news every night. We're not. We're just being told that Navalny's been poisoned, Putin's a murderer, and when the war breaks out in Ukraine, if it does, the Russians are going to be the bad guys. And that means, of course, from the American point of view, from the US point of view, they do not want, particularly Germany and France, to get a reasonable relationship with Russia.
Yeah, but Vladimir Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, is saying that the Ukrainian military are doing everything they can to keep the ceasefire in Donbass.
Well, at the same time, they've just passed a resolution saying that they are going to take back the rebel provinces, and they're moving all of their kit to the front line to do exactly that. Now, the Russian military manoeuvres have simply been to deter them, basically. It's what you do. If you're going to move your military up to the front line, we're going to move our military here to make sure that you can see that if you start a fight, it's not going to be as straightforward as you might think.
Yeah, these regions have had referenda, haven't they? And
yes, they have.
Decided that they're going to stay with the Russians. And in fact,
well, they've not been allowed to join the Russian Federation up to now because the policy that's been pursued by the current government in Russia is that would be provocative. They're trying to create some kind of basis for dialogue and discussion a bit like, you know, what's going on in Northern Ireland. You know, Northern Ireland is not going to be absorbed into the Republic without some kind of discussion. And the same, and also the on the, you know, these eastern breakaway provinces are not, a lot of people have taken out Russian citizenship because that's what the Russians have done. So anybody here can take out Russian citizenship, but we're not going to go the whole hog and say you're part of Russia. Crimea used to be part of Russia until 1954, so that's much more straightforward. They just say, well, we're just taking that back. But the Russians are very well aware that, you know, this breakaway province thing is a two-edged sword. So, you know, you've got all sorts of conflicts across the Balkans, across the Caucasus, on the periphery of Russia, between, you know, small nations or proto-nations potentially breaking out into warfare. And it's therefore necessary to think about the implications for other conflicts if you start taking a hard line in any particular conflict. And what we should really be doing is everybody should own a real discussion about how we're going to manage these kind of conflicts, whether it's between Turkey and the Kurds, the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis, the Russians and the Ukrainians, the British and the Irish, whatever you want to say. You know, they've all got similarities which require, you know, a similar kind of approach where everybody feels that they've got some stake in the outcomes. But of course, the big problem is that each of these conflicts might be resolvable on its own terms, but you've got the overwhelming desire by the deep state in the US, the people who carried out 9/11, to prevent Russia and China from acting independently. They just want, they want access, basically, to the resources in Siberia.
Well, yeah, but that's what they're after. We're just talking about the CIA Mockingbird, ABC, sparking this latest, withdrawal of the ambassador from the Russian ambassador, Antony Antonov, from Washington back to Moscow. But, you know, the Grey Zone this week, for example, has been reporting that the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, is basically the same as the BBC. Questions, they say, about BBC producers' ties to UK intelligence following the May Day White Helmets whitewash. That's just out a couple of days ago by
I read all of that,
Kit Clarenberg on the Grey Zone. So it's a podcast serial designed to rehabilitate the White Helmets' late scandal-stained founder, blaming critics for his demise. So she just seems to be writing this stuff for MI6, and the article explains why they think she is. Their founder, James Le Mesurier, fell to his death from the top floor of an Istanbul home in uncertain circumstances in November 2019. But the idea is that somebody, whoever it was that's killed him, is the critics of the White Helmets, and this operation was nothing to do with MI6.
Well, it looks like Le Mesurier had his fingers in the till. That's what happened to him, it seems. But of course, unless you follow all of these different sources that we're quoting, you won't know anything about it just by watching.
Well, the Grey Zone is certainly an interesting one, isn't it? Anyway, just run through a couple of headlines on antiwar.com. As we were saying, the Russians are saying on there that they're prepared for the worst scenario with the United States. So hence they're absolutely, you can understand that is in lockstep with their withdrawing their ambassador. They're saying we don't have a relationship with the United States. Whatever they want to throw at us, we're ready, you know. So there's also US threatening to send more warships into the Black Sea to send a message to Russia, although I think that message has already been sent. There's something from ISIS seizing a Syrian police station and capturing hostages. So Syria is still on the boil. But before we say goodbye, Martin, is there anything else on the international scene you'd like to draw to our attention this week?
Not really. I think we've pretty much covered it. I would obviously, the situation, my last contribution to RT was about 10 days ago now, and they've banned all Russian RT and other Russian language TV stations in Latvia, which has got nearly 50% of the population are Russian speaking. So I think all the straws are in the air. And don't forget, we've got the new administration in the US. Let's not call it the Biden administration, because I don't think he's really in charge. But they've laid out their stall of what they're going to do, and it looks pretty much like they want confrontation. And of course, the other side are picking up that gauntlet.
Okay, Martin, thanks very much. We're going to disappear off now, have your supper. But we're going to finish with I'm doing a series over the next few weeks of what I think are real classic long form interviews or speeches and whatever. And we'll be looking at the JFK assassination. Also, an interesting talk by Myron Fagan on the Illuminati. These are all things which you just simply would never hear on the mainstream press. And if you were listening to it, you'd probably get back home in your car. You'd be sitting on your drive thinking, goodness me, what's this? And this is one of the things that I used to love doing on BCFM, is because usually listening to our show, it felt like you're listening to pirate radio or something. You think, well, gosh, this can't be the BBC. You can't be allowed to say this, surely. And of course you are. So anyway, tonight's clip is William Cooper, Bill Cooper, who's a radio host in Eager, Arizona, ex-US Naval Intelligence. He was privy to the communications between the headquarters and the various ships out in the US Navy. And so he saw a lot of interesting stuff passing across his desk. He got quite a good idea of how it all works, and also some of the ideologies of the senior people involved. And Bill Cooper then went on to do his he was basically an intelligence gatherer, an investigative journalist for the people, a similar sort of show to this, really. He very sadly died just after the September the 11th attacks, having predicted them in July 2021 by saying, well, bin Laden is going to be blamed for a massive attack on America, July, August, September, 2 or 3 months before it actually happened, which is quite a feat. But anyway, here's Bill talking about, it's an extract from his talk in Lansing, Virginia, I think Lansing is, back in 1996, where he talks here about the ideology. It's actually called the Luciferian philosophy, the ideology he believes of the people who believe that man is an animal, as a kind of counter narrative to the Bible. And this here is an extract from the longer Bill Cooper lecture, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk this week, and I'll do the other ones over the next couple of weeks, from 1996. William Cooper.
Here's the way they look at it. Here's their metaphor for the end of innocence. Adam and Eve were held prisoner in the Garden of Eden by an unjust, cruel, and vindictive God. Until Lucifer, through his agent Satan, set man free from this garden by giving him the gift of intellect. Through the use of intellect, man will conquer the earth, will conquer nature, and will himself become God. It's taught in every Masonic temple in this land, every secret brotherhood, every secret society, every mystical temple, every occult organization teaches the Luciferian philosophy. They do not believe in Lucifer. They do not believe in any entity called a devil, and they do not believe in God. It is a mistake for you to assume that they do. They are atheists in the strictest sense of the word. They are humanists. That's their religion. At the highest level, their goal is to create a world in which the adepts, the thousand points of light, working behind the veil to create the culmination of the great plan, can realize the ultimate happiness for mankind. That's why they don't oppose pornography. That's why they don't oppose certain crimes. That's why they say you should not be put in jail for the rest of your life for murder or anything else. There should be no death penalty, because it was a learning experience. And having gone through that learning experience, you're a better person now. This is what they teach. They believe punishment for these crimes is nothing more than vengeful retribution, which is wrong in their eyes. So these are really the two philosophies that we have competing with each other in the world today. Who brought man the gift of fire? Prometheus. Who was Prometheus? Lucifer. What was the gift of fire? Knowledge, intellect. Hasn't man created industry, culture, society, science from the use of one solitary thing? Fire. Without fire, none of it would have occurred. None of it. Nothing. There would be no society without fire. That's how it's represented in the ancient myths and in the mysteries. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? What is it represented as? A bolt of lightning struck a tree. The tree burst into flames. Ancient man, if you watch the movie Quest for Fire, rushed up and grabbed one of the burning branches, and it burned his hand, and he let it go. He probably didn't go any farther than that the first time. Second time, he may have found a deer that had been roasted by the heat of the fire in the forest, and being hungry, maybe he partook of some of that meat and found that it tasted pretty good. Also, the fire was warm and didn't get cold at night. And this is where the whole battle between the forces of light and darkness comes from. Man sat up on a rock one night watching the sunset and said, "Boy, I'm in deep trouble now. I can't see in the dark. There's wild beasts out there. There's tigers with teeth 7 inches long that want me for dinner. What am I going to do?" He didn't know what to do. Neither would many of us put in that situation. But we would know one thing, we're in deep trouble. And so for a good part of his history, man sat huddled in the darkness in some place that made him feel secure, waiting to be saved. Now remember, folks, I'm not telling you what I believe. I'm telling you what is taught in the mysteries. I'm telling you what our enemies believe. Make no mistake about it, they are our mortal enemies. They want to see us wiped off the face of the earth. Man huddled in this darkness, fearful, trembling, cold, hungry. And around about he could hear the beasts roaring. And sometimes they were roaring because they were after him. And sometimes he was eaten. A man eventually saw another tree struck by lightning and grabbed that branch with that flame on it. And by a little experimentation, he learned how to keep that fire going. And if he could keep the fire going, he knew something nobody else knew, and he became the first king, the first priest, the first scientist, all rolled into one. And he would burn this fire and keep it going. Another man in the cold of the night, wanting to escape from the terrors that were out there, would gravitate toward this glow. And they would see this man sitting there. And if he was kind, he would let them come to the fire. And they would be warm. And they would be protected. Because if the wild beast came, he'd pick up a branch and shove it in its face, and the beast would go away. And so the forces of light overcame the forces of darkness, and in the sunshine of the morning, the newly risen, resurrected child that had died the night before, their Savior, warmed them and saved them from the terrors of the Prince of Darkness. You have to study these things to understand your enemy. Any general who ventures upon a battlefield without understanding the enemy is doomed to defeat. just like a militia that forms itself upon a peninsula has already created its own concentration camp, unless it has a navy.
So that's Bill Cooper, and I put the full version of that lecture from Lansing back in 1997 on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. This thing about the enemy, well, both David Icke and Tommy Robinson, I believe, are nutter magnets. So what they're doing is effectively what exactly the same as a system developed by MI5 in the Second World War for the double cross agents. What they did is they managed to turn a whole load of Nazi agents who were here in the UK and to get them to send back disinformation back to Nazi Germany. But of course, they couldn't just send disinformation. They had to send good information as well. So there was a lot of stuff which wasn't getting into the British press, etc., because of the censorship. And so they sent back reports of genuine attacks, some of which had been staged. In other words, they were made to look like bomb attacks or whatever, or fires around factories and these sorts of things. But they mixed them in, the double cross, the people running it from MI5, running these double cross agents. Most of them realized that they were actually working for the British, but some of them didn't. Anyway, who knows whether David Icke or Tommy Robinson know who they're working for, but the principle is exactly the same. It's what you do is you feed great information, as some of it is, that comes from both Icke and Robinson, but it's also fed also with really toxic, poisonous stuff at the same time. So I just think it's fascinating that exactly the same techniques are used today against us as were used by MI5 against the Nazis in the Second World War. Funny that, isn't it? Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Thanks particularly to Matt Campbell and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Since Google and Yahoo have manoeuvred me onto their email lists and then banned the lists for posts I couldn't moderate or for fake anti-Semitism claims, the only way to be included on this weekly email circulation list is to email me now at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. Happy to have some suggestions from you folks as to where else I can go to host that list. But anyway, you'll find that address on the contact tab at www.thisweek.org.uk. You can also find my books. I've been uploading some most recent versions of those up via www.bilderberg.org, which this week I noticed has also been banned, like Fort Russ has, by Facebook. If you try and share anything on there, Facebook and Zuckerberg stop you. So you have to go there directly. That's www.bilderberg.org, and find some other way of sharing it. Possibly to you could share it to the payhip.com version, where you can actually download and buy the books. The first one is called The Traitors of Arnhem. That's the Martin Bormann book about the Battle of Arnhem and the foundation of the Bilderberg conferences, and it's got a pretty comprehensive Bormann timeline involved in that. That's the one I was commissioned to write by Charles Hewitt at Pen and Sword Books, and then when he saw my treatment for it, which was 4 or 5 pages of A4, he decided, no, I'm not interested in that anymore, because it was all too political. And then there's my article collection, which is called The Siege of Heaven, and a collection of articles on secret societies and hidden power since the late medieval period, and that's called The Siege of Heaven Reader. So they're all available for free downloads, or you can buy them if you want to support the show via, which is a much better ebook copy, at www.bilderberg.org, or else you can just go to thisweek.org.uk, and all the links to that are there on the Martin Bormann timeline tab. If you've got a site or a story you'd like to share, you think there's anything I've missed or I've got a correction, please do reply. Well, one correction was that the Robert Redfield was from the CDC, not from the National Institute of Health, as I said on that report. So I'll quickly clear that mistake up earlier on. But if you've got something you'd like to share, anything I've missed or a correction, please do reply to the weekly email, or just email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. Details on the show pages, and email me with a link or two, or even a scan of what you have if possible. And if you may even suggest an interviewee, and and send me some of their contact details, that sort of thing. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like if you've got those. The Not the BCFM Politics Show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details are at thisweekoneword.org.uk, and you'll also find my several YouTube channels out there too. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. This show is repeated 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and at Sunday lunch at Camberley's Radio QUK.com. We're working with Richie to get it onto the richieallen.co.uk. And do please make recordings of these streams if you can, but sometimes they are down. Well, we can't get them. At least that was happening at BCFM anyway. Feel free to download and rebroadcast the show anywhere you like, and we'll list you here. But do credit us at thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.